You know these tax credits.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, be right back.
I will be right back.
And just public hearing on everything?
Yes.
Just remember, I stuck with you last time.
Well, I stuck with you.
Best timing in the world.
Let parents make choices.
Best timing in the world.
Yeah, the point is, you can't. That's why you can't have a religious exemption without having a general non-medical exemption.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare. It is Wednesday, February 18th, and I want to advise everyone that we will be dealing with some very controversial topics today, and some of us feel very passionate one way or the other. I feel that if you feel passionate, you still need to be sensitive. We want to have decorum in here, so I would hope that everyone would treat each other respectfully, and no clapping, no cheering for your side, et cetera. This is a public hearing. All right. We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 37, 38, 39, and 42. Chris, would you please come up and just give us an overview of the tax credits, and then we will reschedule these bills on March 11th. So then we will have our formal public hearing then, so we can give more time to the immunization bill.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. And I'll be as brief as possible, just the very overview of the tax credit report that was released to the Department of Revenue Committees a couple of weeks ago. This was a bill that was required. This is the first time this report has been produced by Legislative Revenue Office. And it goes over the 18 tax credits that are sunsetting this session. The four credits before you were the Rural Medical Practice Credit, the Cost in Lieu of Nursing Home Care Tax Credit, the Long-Term Care Insurance Credit, and the Loss of Limbs Tax Credit. And our understanding from leadership is that the intent is for the policy committees to work through the tax credits in your committee and focus on an evaluation of the tax credits, really getting at the policy purpose for each of the tax credits to understand why the tax credits exist in statute and why they should continue to be in statute or if they should be modified in any way, shape, or form. And the report is structured, the heart of the report is in Section 3. The first two sections are kind of an overview of the tax expenditure concept. The heart of the report is broken down into chapters, and each piece on the individual tax credits talks about the policy purpose, a description of the mechanics of the tax credit, and then a policy analysis of the tax credit, and then there's some information about other states that have similar tax credits and potentially some administrative costs related to the tax credits. The biggest challenge in evaluating the tax credits is the need for a clear policy purpose, basically a statement of why the tax credit exists in tax law. So that would be one of the foundation principles to get out of the committee. And my staff, my time this session is devoted to being available to the policy committees to help you work through any of the questions or any of the analysis that you would like done during session. Now, to that end, the Appendix D in the report is a series of about 10 questions that it's not really a checklist of questions that need to be answered. They're really just suggestions from LRO about questions to get the policy discussion moving forward. Basically, why does it exist, and is it effective? What about direct spending programs? Any potential modifications to the tax credit? And then it'll be the choice of the committee to either let the tax credit sunset or let it continue as is, or suggest modifications. And each of the policy committees are doing the same thing for the credits in their committees. Then the process will be those tax credits will be forwarded to the Joint Tax Credit Committee, at least the ones that the policy committees feel should be continued. And then within the Joint Committee on Tax Credits, they'll be working with the budget, the tax credit budget, if you will, on how much they can spend on the tax credits to try and fit them all into whatever revenue they have to spend on the tax credits. So an example of some potential information that would be valuable for that committee would be potential modifications to the tax credits, whether it be expansions or limitations on the tax credit with respect to cost. So I think you have a copy of that report that provides basically some initial information on the tax credit. The report is kind of a work in progress. There's still a lot of more information that could be added, especially to the analysis piece, and potential modifications to the policies contained within those tax credits. But it's really that discussion that leadership is hoping the policy committees will have about why the tax credit exists, what should it look like, and then recommendations to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits about funding levels for the credits.
So, committee, what I did is I had my staff take this report, and I don't have the title of it. It says research report. What is the title of it? So that
2016 expiring tax credits. It's in OLIS under the Revenue Committee. It's also on the LRO publications page.
And so what they did, like for Senate Bill 37, they actually just copied that particular chapter for the rural tax credit or rural medical provider tax credit. And they did that for each one of them. And that might be very helpful for you to do, because we truly need to address the policy piece. And it is sort of new, and I really don't like it, but we're stuck with it. All right. Comments for Chris? All right. Thank you very much. And is there anyone here that came? Okay. So, Chris, so there are two that signed up, John Mangan and Matt Swanson. Do you want to testify today, or do you want to testify March 11th? Where are you in the?
March
11th. And what about Matt? He's going to come back March 11th too then. All right. Okay, thank you very much, Chris. And with that, we're going to close the public hearing on 37, 38, 39, and Senate Bill 42. And I would like to, would you call the, get the senators here? I will like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 442, Azina, would you please explain the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 442 requires the Oregon Health Authority to adopt by rule a schedule which may impose different dates by which children of different ages or children attending different types of schools must submit a signed document that a parent is declining one or more immunization on behalf of a child if the child enters kindergarten or transferred to the school before March 1st, 2014. There is a -3 amendment and there's no revenue impact on the introduced bill, and there may be a fiscal impact, but there's no statement issued yet.
Okay, we were going to start with Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, Senator Alan Bates, Senator Chuck Thompson, and Representative Newt Bueller.
You're one for four, isn't it?
One for four.
Yeah. I think they're coming, but if you want me to start, Madam Chair, I'm
yes, please
happy
do. I would love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from District 17 and a family physician. I want to start by just offering a summary of the -3 amendments, which is what I'm hoping that we will consider rather than the original text of Senate Bill 442. To be clear, the -3 amendments would delete Section 1 sub C of ORS 433.267, and as a result would take away all non-medical exemptions for immunizations. We would only allow either full immunization status for children attending school in Oregon or attending daycare, or a medical exemption from a licensed provider. Non-medical exemptions that parents have already obtained would no longer be valid, and that the health authority would, as they already have, determined by rule what medical conditions would be eligible for deferral of immunizations and which health care providers would be authorized to provide them. It's fairly straightforward. Before I want to go any further, I do want to clear the air about one issue. As you can imagine, I've received a certain amount of attention about this bill and a certain amount of responses in social media, one of which I'd like to address directly, which is my relationship with the pharmaceutical industry. There are people who are alleging that I am promoting this bill because I've been paid money by pharmaceutical companies and vaccine manufacturers. I have worked for Oregon Health and Science University for over 15 years. In our practices, we do not allow drug representatives in our clinics. We do not accept drug samples. We do not accept any gifts from drug manufacturers. Further, I have never accepted an honorarium from a drug company. Furthermore, in 2005, I worked with the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians to make the OAFP pharmaceutical-free. We do not accept even unrestricted educational grants. And personally, as a legislator, when I became a legislator a little over 3 years ago, I made the decision, which I've held to this day and will continue to hold, that I do not accept political campaign contributions from pharmaceutical manufacturers. I will continue to hold by this. I think it is an inherent conflict of interest for me as a physician to accept anything from the pharmaceutical industry. So I just want to be clear about that, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Immunizations are one of the greatest public health advances in the history of the world. I think the only other comparable advance is clean water in terms of public health. That being said, I have enormous amount of respect for parental authority and religious autonomy, and especially as I, as a Jewish person in a state where there are very few Jewish people, I'm a religious minority, and I deal with that issue on an almost daily basis. That being said, there are times when the public need outweighs the rights of parental authority. This is particularly true in the context of highly communicable diseases such as measles, whooping cough, and rubella. These are really serious diseases, and it's one of the only times I think that the state has the right to intervene on parental authority. Furthermore, extensive research shows that not one single world religion prohibits immunization. You will note that the Church of Christ scientists, commonly known as the Christian scientists, are remaining neutral on this bill. I believe that religious and philosophical exemptions should be reserved for decisions where science does not play a role. And of note, the Supreme Court of Mississippi, in the Brown versus Stone case in 1979, stripped the religious exemption from the Missouri law because of exactly this reason. They believed that the interests of the state far outweighed any concerns held by parents about the safety of vaccines because these diseases are so dangerous for the public health. And it is for exactly this reason that I'm choosing to make this change. As a mother, I know how scary it is to give these immunizations to my children. But I did it anyway, because as a doctor, as a scientist, I know that they're safe. I know that they are safe. The risk to the health of Oregonians from these diseases, should we reach the epidemic status that I think we are at risk of, is far greater than any risk imposed by these immunizations. And it's for only this reason, because Oregon has the highest exemption rate in the nation, that we are at a point now of saying this change needs to be made. You will hear today from people talking about the effects that these diseases have had on them. You will hear from my colleagues who will tell you this is not a partisan issue, this is not just the doctors who are thinking this. You will hear from public health officials who will talk to you about the importance of this. You will hear from pediatric infectious disease specialists. You will also hear from people who believe that their children or they have been injured by vaccines. It is true that in the past, some of our formulations have been less safe. Those formulations have been changed in response to these problems, and they are now dramatically safer than they've ever been. There's no question that some people still have adverse reactions to vaccines, but they are extraordinarily rare and generally fairly limited. I urge the committee to support the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 442 for the sake of the public health of all Oregonians. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chuck Thompson from Hood River, District 26, also in the Happy Valley, Mount Hood area, southeast part. I got a lot of districts, so I got all kind of, they moved me all over, so I got Clackamas area too. So I'm here today in support to show that this is a bipartisan, this is not a partisan issue at all. I approached Senator Hayward in November with this issue, and I keep reminding her that we talked about doing this before any of these outbreaks occurred.
Yes.
Because I have a doctor in Hood River, Dr. Charles Haney, that I've known for years, and he's always been a big advocate for immunizations. And I promised him I would work on that this session, and then with all the outbreaks that occurred, I think if we don't do something and make this and pass this bill, our the percentage of people with these problems are going to increase. For example, just as of yesterday, measles continue to spread, reaching 141 cases in 17 states. The CDC reported yesterday that it has confirmed 141 cases of measles since January 1 as part of two separate outbreaks, plus several additional cases not linked to those two outbreaks. As of February 13th, an outbreak linked to a group of unvaccinated people who visited Disneyland in December had 113 cases. Another 10 cases were linked to a second outbreak, and 18 more cases weren't linked to a specific outbreak. And then, I wasn't even going there thinking about this, because my generation, everybody got vaccinated. It's just what you did. You didn't even think about it. And now we've come a long ways where the ideas, I mean, just we all know the stories about the internet thing, and I even told my wife today, well, everything on the internet is true, isn't it? But I think we know that isn't true, and I think we're into a generation that have not been vaccinated, and that's just starting to show up. And I was having dinner with my wife and her new husband this weekend, and she's a nurse.
Your wife.
What did I say?
Your wife and her new husband.
No, I didn't mean that. Christy, I didn't mean that. That happens to me all the time. Let me rephrase that. I know my wife's watching on computer. Okay. Oh, no. Sorry about that.
She may have one after this, you know.
Let me.
On purpose, just
can you
break.
Back up the tape?
One word for you. Flowers.
I did that last
week. Lots of flowers.
My daughter and her new husband.
There we go.
Okay.
Thanks. Brought up the thing, because they're getting close to thinking about having children, and she said, "We are not going to. If my friends and their children aren't vaccinated, we're not." Going to associate with them. And that really hit home. So how many other people are out there with that same kind of thought? And we don't need that. That's not going to be good for the citizens of Oregon. And that's why I'm in support of this measure.
Thank you. Yeah. And Dr. Mueller, you can come up and here. I got
another meeting.
You got another meeting?
Yeah.
Okay.
If I could, Senator Thompson, congratulations. You just made the signee die tape.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely. Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Alan Bates. I'm a state senator, and I've been a primary care physician in family practice for embarrassingly over 35 years in Southern Oregon. That makes me very old. When I walked out here to the committee today, I was thinking, what can I say that you might not hear 12 times over in the next few days or few hours? And so I want to give you a little different perspective possibly on this that might be helpful. It's part medical, but not completely. I'm of a generation that we didn't get immunized. We didn't have immunizations for polio, measles, mumps, or rubella. We had tetanus, and that tetanus shot about take your arm off when you got it. And that's the only immunizations I had in the first years of my life. I got measles, I got mumps, I got chicken pox. I do believe I was immunized for the hard measles, but I'm not sure because it was just coming out as I came of age. I guess I could also say if you look at me carefully, you can see I'm a poster child for why you should get immunized, but we're not going to go there right now. I remember in summertime that we couldn't go to the lake, we couldn't go to movies, we couldn't go to places in the summer because polio was more rampant then, and we couldn't get polio vaccines because they weren't available. When they did become available, they were given on a mass basis at schools. We would line up in schoolyards and get our shots, and we were happy to get them. Kids may be passing out once in a while, but we got the shots done, and kids were saved. I had many friends who became paralyzed by polio, one who died. And they were in something called iron lungs, which most people had never even heard of anymore. Vaccines work, and they save lives. Later in the early 1970s, I had a job where I went to schools in Washington State that were set up for the blind and the deaf, for children that were blind and deaf. Most of them were there because of communicable diseases, not because of a congenital problem they were born with or from an accident. They were there because they'd gotten the measles, or their mothers had been infected with German measles during pregnancy. Those days are gone. That facility that I used to visit the most in Vancouver, Washington, is now closed because there's no more kids that have these problems at that level and that quantity. Vaccines work. We've had 30 years for this storm to be brewing, 30 years in which talk show hosts have blown way out of proportion the risk of these vaccines versus their benefit. We've had one doctor lose his medical license in Great Britain for an article he wrote for Lancet, which was completely false about autism. He cooked the data, faked the data, and has been disbarred, as far as we are concerned, as far as ever practicing medicine or ever being listened to again. But that still is out in the public mind. It is time to move past all that. We now have a situation where we have our first true epidemic since vaccines were available for children. It's the measles vaccine and the measles epidemic that you're going to be hearing about. There are others out there that are worse. Part of my district is in Ashland. We've had a pertussis outbreak there already twice, and we'll have more as time goes by if we don't do something. We have one school there where the immunization rate is zero. Zero. And that is just a prescription for disaster. I'm actually concerned that somebody is going to go visit Afghanistan or somewhere in Eastern Africa or even Bangladesh and bring polio back to people who have not been vaccinated, and we'll have polio back in this country, which is a truly, absolutely devastating disease. Admittedly, measles, mumps, rubella, a lot of people survive, do fairly well with. But a percentage of them, a significant percentage, have permanent damage in hearing, vision, developmental disabilities, and some even die. And we have a subclass of kids who have had bone marrow transplants and can't be immunized immediately. If they get any of these diseases, they are likely to die too. So an innocent child who has gone through leukemia and gotten a bone marrow transplant is at risk because the child next to him didn't get immunized and is carrying a disease that they don't even know they have yet, because most of the incubation periods, and these are a couple of weeks before any signs or symptoms appear. The vaccines have been made much better. As I said, the tetanus shot used to knock you off your feet. It doesn't anymore. I get mine every 5 years, and I cry, and they make me roll up my sleeve, but I get it because I work on a farm a lot, and I don't want to get tetanus. We had a problem with mercury for a time in the vaccines, and Senator Knopp and I worked together on that and got that resolved. The pertussis vaccine is still effective and much safer than it used to be. So these vaccines are much better. They're safer. There's still a chance for reactions, very, very, very low reaction rates, and the benefit outweighs the risk by thousands to one. It's time for us to go ahead and do this mandate and make the only exception to it be a medical one. Other states have done it. I was kind of surprised to find out that at bastion of liberality, Mississippi has done it already, and their rate is about 92%, I believe.
99.5, Senator.
Thank you. If Mississippi can do this, I think Oregon might manage it. So I'll end my testimony there. If there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer them. But it's way past time to do this. I appreciate Senator Hayward's attempts and leadership on this. I support her completely on it. And when those emails come in from people who are very, very angry, send a few to me too. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Buehler.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson, remaining members of the Senate Health Care Committee. My name is Newt Buehler. I represent House District 54, which is Bend. And I'm also an orthopedic surgeon and happen to have a degree in microbiology many years ago from Oregon State. And I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 442, and very proud to be sitting here with my physician colleagues from the Senate. I'm unfortunately the only physician in the House, or there would be more of us, I'm sure, here. I formally submitted a record of support from St. Charles Health System, which I encourage you to read. It's very well done. It's from the chief physician officer and also the CEO. And I'm just going to, I don't want to repeat things that other people have said, but I want to give you a few highlights from that letter, and then personally why I think this bill is so important in removing non-medical exemptions for vaccinations and ensuring that kids are really safe from these preventable diseases. You know, I'm all about freedom. That's one of my core beliefs. Until it starts to do harm to others. And this is really the key issue with regards to vaccinations. And as a doctor, you know, nothing is more important than protecting my patients, especially children. And they're particularly affected by these diseases. But in my professional life, even as an orthopedic surgeon, I don't see that many children now. But I treat a lot of the long-term effects of these diseases, such as polio, which people in their adult years, I'm still seeing from the time in the United States we didn't have those vaccinations. And I have to do major reconstructive surgeries to take care of the ravages of that disease. So it's particularly distressing to me to think that we'd be putting our kids today at risk of those kinds of outcomes as they get older. And let me just read you some of the sections that are, I think, particularly pertinent from the letter from St. Charles Medical Center. And I'm quoting now. Today, few parents can imagine their children getting a vaccine-preventable disease such as polio. Yet the CDC reports that two recent outbreaks of measles has infected 141 people in 17 states, including one person in Oregon, and could infect more. Like polio, measles is a highly contagious, potentially serious viral disease that poses a great risk to unvaccinated people. Alarmingly, the number of people in Central Oregon who fall in this category is growing. In particular, I'm concerned about the people in Bend who I represent, and here's the statistics from Deschutes County. In 2003 to the 2004 school year, Deschutes County Public Health Department reported that 4.9% of kindergartners in the county were non-medically exempt from vaccinations. This means that their parents did not get them immunized for religious or philosophical reasons. Compare that, fast forward 10 years, and that rate has grown to 10%. And that is significant because it is thought that if you fall below, correct me if I'm wrong, about 92%, you eliminate something called herd immunity, which starts to mean that the general population is not sufficiently protected. And that's a very important milestone to fall below.
It's actually about 94% for measles, so we're well below already.
Well below. Now, in each of these numbers, sometimes it's easy to get lost in the numbers, but behind each of them is a real story. That kid who gets a preventable infectious disease that has long-term health repercussions that they'll have to deal with the rest of their life. And this bill helps prevent the growth of those kids who are unprotected. And that's why myself and my physician colleagues in St. Charles has written in support of Senate Bill 442. And again, a final quote from St. Charles. As the region's largest provider of health care services, St. Charles Health System is supportive of vaccinating our children. Years of rigorous scientific research show us that vaccines are both safe and effective. To put our children at risk of being infected with diseases that are almost entirely preventable is deeply unsettling to our providers. And finally, I personally think one of the fundamental roles of government is to protect those most vulnerable. And when necessary, we need to lead people to do the right thing, even when it's difficult and controversial. I can't stress to you enough that from my role and training as a doctor, I assure you vaccines overall are much safer than the risk you pose at getting these infectious diseases. And I really, seriously urge your support of Senate Bill 442. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Senators and Representative. Questions? All right. Thank you. We have 50 people signed up to testify, and we've had just four, and they took 20 minutes. So you know that we need to try to consolidate and not keep repeating over and over. The next panel is Katrina Hedberg, Muriel
De Laverne.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg, and I am the health officer and state epidemiologist with the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here to provide the scientific data on childhood immunizations, which the Centers for Disease Control has labeled one of the 10 greatest public health advances of the 20th century. Again, I think it was alluded to, many of these diseases were with us in the last century. In the 1900s, smallpox, for example, killed, sickened more than 20,000 people and killed 900. In 1920, measles sickened more than 450,000 people and killed 4,600. And diphtheria sickened 148,000 people and killed 13,000. So, you know, the news is that widespread immunization, these diseases are relatively rare. I think, as was alluded to, when they get introduced in the population, if our immunization rates go down, then we see outbreaks of these diseases again. And while in the United States these diseases are relatively rare, in other parts of the world that don't have such high immunization rates, they're still relatively common. And so each of these diseases, if you will, is but a plane flight away. Our up-to-date immunization rates among Oregon 2-year-olds is nothing to be proud of. It's around 71%, which is less than the national average. And even though the rates have been increasing, it falls well below the healthy people 2020 objective of 80%. Again, as was spoken about, even though these aren't relatively common, the decreasing rates of immunization have led to outbreaks, the most recent of which is the measles outbreak in California. Luckily, we haven't seen many cases in Oregon as a result of that. We do have outbreaks here of pertussis or whooping cough, and over the past 10 years, not only have we had a number of kids who've gotten sick, but we've had 5 deaths in Oregon in infants since 2003. So again, these diseases are extremely important. The vaccines are highly effective. We know that. And just as an example, hepatitis A, when I started in the public health division in early in 1990, we had a high rate of almost 3,000 cases. And then in 2014, we only had 16 cases totally. So childhood vaccination against hepatitis A has really led to that disease plummeting.
Dr. Hedberg, could we Pat Allen is here just to give a brief testimony. Can we interrupt yours and let him?
You can,
because he has another meeting to go to.
Absolutely.
I feel badly.
Don't.
Thanks, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Allen. I live in Sherwood, Oregon with my wife and 3 kids. I work here in Salem, but today I'm taking some personal time to talk about this issue that I feel really passionate about. And listening to Dr. Bates earlier, I think the thing that I can briefly do is put a couple of faces to some of the stories that or some of the data that you've heard about. I want to introduce you to my grandparents, to the extent that'll stay up there. Would you? Thank you. That's John and Kate Winandy. They were born just before and just after the turn of the last century. He was a grave digger in Chicago, and she took in laundry. The thing that you can't tell from that picture about them is that they couldn't hear, neither of them. They spent virtually all of their lives speaking sign language because they lost their hearing to childhood illness when they were both about 3 years old. And that wasn't at all uncommon. My mom told stories. She was born in the 30s, told stories regularly of being shipped off to this or that relative to be able to spend time with someone who was sick with a particular thing so that you'd get sick with that thing when you were young, because the effects at that time, blindness, deafness, sterility, were much, much less severe than if you were exposed to them later, brain injury, death, those kinds of paralysis, those kinds of effects. And so this was a really serious issue. I was born in 1962, evidently I cut on the Senator Bates side of the line versus the Senator Thompson side of the line. I was not... the measles vaccine was not yet widely available, and I contracted measles when I was an infant. And my mom told stories of my nearly dying from the disease. Now, I imagine a mother's stories of her children's illnesses probably are like fish tales that might get a little longer with the telling over time. And so was I really medically in danger of my life? Like most of the people you're going to hear from, I'm not an expert in immunology or virology or medicine or anything like that, so I really can't say. I know that she was afraid. I, at that point, was her only child, and she was terrified of the high fever, and she was terrified that I would die. And so when my children were born in the early 90s, early and mid-90s, there was just simply no question of vaccinating them, as my later brother and sister and I were vaccinated throughout the 60s when vaccines became more more widely prevalent. And so really it's that notion of fear that I think is something that's at the root of this. We often talk today, when you read comments about vaccines, about the risk of vaccines versus the risk of not vaccinating. And so I guess I'd ask you to, again, look at my grandparents' picture and compare that risk not to the risk of not vaccinating today, but the risk of not vaccinating before about 1960, when those risks really were deafness, blindness, sterility, paralysis, death, and those kinds of things. I'm a lifelong Oregonian, and it really pains me to say it, but Mississippi and West Virginia, I think, maybe have this one right, and they're not any less free, and they don't love their children any less than we do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for letting me interrupt.
All right. Dr. Thank Hedberg, you, please. Yeah, thank you, Pat, for sharing your personal story.
All right, thank you. So I think it was alluded to as well that vaccinating the population really serves a dual purpose. It protects the kids themselves who get vaccinated, but also it provides what's called community immunity and has been also referred to as herd immunity. And what this means is that the people, because there's less of the disease in the environment or the infection, people who can't be immunize themselves, like children who have cancer, as Senator Bates alluded to, they can be protected. What's happening when our immunization rates fall below this immunity level is that you start to see outbreaks, as we did in the case of measles now in Southern California, that has spread to the rest of the country. As was also mentioned, so I won't go into it, but vaccines are very safe. The side effects tend to be very minor. In addition, if kids, they're very effective, and if a child who has been immunized happens to get an infection, they tend to have a much milder form of infection. So it either prevents it completely or it attenuates and makes the illness less less severe. The Oregon Public Health Division, we do have several tools that are available to providers. We have an immunization registry, and that helps us to track everybody who has been immunized and serves as a tool for providers and parents. And it is an evidence-based. It's one of the standards for the country. It sets the bar. The immunization program, we don't work in a vacuum by any means. We have several advisory groups. Were this law to pass, we would have a rural advisory group that includes not only providers, but members of the public and parents, et cetera, to give advice to us and feedback. So in summary, I think that immunizing children against vaccine-preventable diseases really prevents them from developing potentially severe illness themselves and does protect the larger community as well, and particularly vulnerable persons who themselves cannot be immunized. So thanks for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Muriel.
Okay, thank you. Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the Senate Healthcare Committee, I'm Muriel DeLaverne-Brown. I am chair of the Coalition of Local Health Officials, and I'm also public health director in Crook County, Oregon, in Prineville, close to Bend. So, you know, and I think one of the points that we want to bring up is when we talk about it being a global world and when we talk about kind of how people travel, I think about Central Oregon. And between all of us in the three counties, we're always working together. Kids and families are traveling between the three counties. So it's not, you know, it really is sort of that type of world where everyone travels. And so I think that's one of the pieces that's very different about this now and looking at the importance of this. The Coalition of Local Health Officials represent 34 local public health departments in Oregon. Our job is to really protect the public and prevent spread of disease. And that's really what this is about. The Coalition of Local Health Officials supports Senate Bill 442, and that would remove the non-medical vaccine exemption. I'm not going to go into detail on the vaccines. Many people have done that already. But I think really vaccines are a tool, as Katrina said, that we really use in the public health departments. They're safe, effective. And I think if we look at what's happening, not only in the United States, but thinking about the measles outbreak, 2014, there was a mumps outbreak in Ohio, and also pertussis cases in Oregon in 2012. We had the most cases seen since 1953. So I think it's important to think about what we're seeing in that increase. Oregon's law currently makes it relatively easy to opt out, and I think that's what we're talking about. As Katrina mentioned, we do have one of the highest non-medical exemptions in the country. And for a public health official who's looking at trying to deal with outbreaks in a community, we really have to think about that. And, you know, the next outbreak's kind of around the corner, as we all know, in public health. So we have to think about how do we prevent those from happening. One of the things we do at the local level is we really work with our partners. We work with local child care centers and schools to protect kids. And part of that is to enforce the school exclusion immunization law. So it's timely that this is happening today. This is actually exclusion day. And in 2014, we sent, actually across the state, we sent 32,345 letters to parents and guardians letting them know that their kids needed some type of vaccination. A total of 5,227 children were kept out of school or child care because they did not get those in the timely manner. And from the local level, where we send letters, we send reminders, we call, we do everything we can so those kids get vaccinated so they don't end up missing school. In Kirk County today, we actually pulled in some extra staff, and we actually offer clinics all day long because, and we work with the schools so they know that, so the kids can come to the department and get their shots that they need so they don't miss school. So it's important that we look at kind of the role of what public health does in this too. I think part of what we have to think about too is this really provides, I think, you know, adding an amendment to this really provides a clarity and safety message to parents, facilities, and schools that this is safe, this is effective. I am one of those ones who had measles as a kid. I sort of remember how awful that was. And, you know, it's really important that we think about how do we protect these kids and how do, and it's not just the young children, it's also others that are immunocompromised. It's young babies who aren't able to get the vaccines yet. So I think there's another population. This amendment, the Senate Bill 442, will provide the community protection to our most vulnerable, and that's what's important to us in public health. So thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to alternate between pro and con, so let's call up Vern Sabo, Bob Snee, and Diane Gunmanson.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, Vern Sabo representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. A little background, I'm a chiropractic physician board certified in orthopedics, forensic science, and neurology. I currently serve on the State of Oregon's Health Evidence Review Commission and on the subcommittee on evidence-based guidelines and coverage guidance. I also serving on, and hopefully I'll get this name right, the back and spine pain prioritized list reorganization task force and the integrated medical advisory group that Bruce Goldberg appointed me to when he was director at the Oregon Health Authority, and most recently appointed to, again, to the Oregon Board of Chiropractic Examiners evidence-based guidelines and coverage guidance for our profession. We're revisiting our evidence-based guidelines and looking at the categories of injury and what levels of evidence support what interventions. So we are in opposition, strong opposition to the Dash 3 amendments. The Dash 3 amendments eliminate the recently achieved online educational voucher system for those who wish to exempt as they go through the online course and print their vouchers, and they've been educated, they've achieved informed consent, which is basic to any medical intervention that you achieve informed consent, meaning that you've described the procedure to the individual, any viable alternatives, the inherent risks to that procedure, and if they have any questions, and then that individual has the right to say yes or no. Now, we've heard that this would only leave a medical exemption, which is flawed. We see consistently with our patients that explanation, that conversation frequently doesn't happen. And I had a patient 2 days ago who told me that her son, 17-year-old son, came out from a routine visit and told his mom that, well, I got a vaccine for a sexually transmitted disease. And she said, what? She asked the secretary to find out that he had been injected with the HPV vaccine without her consent or knowledge. And so the other issue is herd immunity. We'll have a immunologist and a scientist that'll come and refer to the herd immunity that has been disproven multiple times. It is flawed. It is actually setting us up for failure. It's actually weakening the herds without getting into the details of antibody titers and response, non-responders, low responders, and what are known as high responders versus cell-mediated immunity, which is lifelong immunity. Now, we've heard that, and this, again, is germane to informed consent and very important, and I've included this in my testimony, which I forgot to pass out and still have it here. I think I sent it in to the email. So according to the National Reporting System, the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, there's an average of 30,000 reports each year. 13% of those are deemed as serious. 13% would be roughly 4,000, and everyone knows that these are underreported numbers simply because this is a voluntary system. When Senate Bill 132 was discussed during the 2013 session, repeatedly public health officials and others assured us that the religious exemption would not be done away with, and that, in fact, that parents, once they had gone through the online program, could exempt their children for any reason whatsoever, and that this was not taking away the religious exemption. So I think you have a legislative council legal opinion that since that was offered and the parents could go through the online educational program, achieve informed consent, that did not take away the religious exemption. It was fine. I think it needs to be vented through legislative council that with this new -3 amendments, if they passed, if in fact it would conflict with the Oregon Constitution.
And we have made that request, and at the March 11th, I believe March 11th is where we're having the informational. Yeah,
March 9th.
Okay. We'll have some constitutional law and legislative council.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair. Parents that are exempting, I think there's another misconception that they're misinformed and that they simply look at the lay press. Well, I'm a parent, and when it came to my son, I assumed the truth was somewhere between the spectrum of what I conceived as anti-vaccine zealots. Incidentally, the Oregon Chiropractic Association is not against vaccines that are safe and effective. We are pro-informed consent. On the other end of the spectrum was my little sister, the nurse, head of the immunization program in Deschutes County, saying not to vaccinate Jackson is quackery. Why are we even having this conversation? I went deep into the literature, the science, and that's what we need to rely on here. We've been getting the same sound bites, excuse me, over and over. And the focus of mine was on the relationship of vaccines to autoimmunity. Can I get some water?
Go get him. He's got it. Knope's got it. Charmin.
Just a couple other things. The other thing that has to be taken into consideration in this situation of informed consent and the absolute need for it is the obvious continued and consistent examples of corporate malfeasance by the very manufacturers of the vaccines. Let's talk about Merck. Merck Pharmaceutical, who produces the MMR vaccine, was fined $950 million right around 2004 for its blockbuster drug Vioxx, which they misreported and underreported the cardiovascular risks, heart attacks relative to the drug. They also promoted it for uses not intended. And in a 2008 editorial in the American Medical Association's journal, JAMA, the editorial questioned whether or not Merck might have deliberately manipulated dozens of academic documents published in the medical literature in order to promote Vioxx under false pretenses. It's also been estimated that some 60,000 Americans lost their lives directly to the adverse events relative to Vioxx, and they were cardiovascular. We've had Dr. Wakefield mentioned, the doctor from the UK. They lost his license and that he falsified his research data. Those are blatantly untrue, and Dr. Wakefield will present in front of this committee on March 9th. His co-workers and himself have been exonerated. Their research has been duplicated multiple times in five other countries, and you have those. I've provided those citations. Continuing along the lines of malfeasance, in 2012, two Merck virologists, former employees, have filed whistleblower lawsuits alleging that, and also there was a group of physicians and a direct payer of the for the vaccine, that they lied about the efficacy of the mumps vaccine. Now, Merck attorneys, of course, have been attempting to keep that from trial, but Judge Jones in the Pennsylvania federal court has now cleared it for trial, and it is going to trial. Just recently, more recently, and I'll be in Washington, D.C., this is one of the issues we'll be covering. Just 5 months ago, Dr. William Thompson, senior scientist at the Center for Disease Control, has turned whistleblower and has validated, he alleges, he and his coworkers omitted very strategic, very specific, very key data relative to African-American boys that were before the age of 38 months, and that data revealed that they had nearly a threefold increase in autism. Congressional hearings are being scheduled again to address the issue of research misconduct and also the connection, plausible connection to autism. For all of those reasons, again, we are not anti-vaccine. We're pro-informed consent. A mother or a father, an individual, a parent must have the fundamental right to determine whether or not their child gets any medical procedure that has an inherent risk to that procedure. That completes my testimony. I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Thank you. Seeing none, please proceed.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Diane Goodmanson. I have a chiropractic practice in Hillsboro, Oregon, and I am a mother of a son with autism. I want to strongly say that I am not anti-vaccine. I'm not an anti-vaccine zealot. I actually, in past and present, am sometimes embarrassed by colleagues of mine who are anti-vaccine zealots because I feel that it makes the profession I love look backward and unscientific. I believe actually in the disease prevention and public health merits of vaccines. However, as I first stated, I am the mother of a son with autism, and I'm here to tell my story. My son Jeffrey was born in 1992, and until he received the second dose of the MMR vaccine, he was developmentally on track for his age. When he was 2 years old, we hear a lot of things about terrible twos and two-year-olds pitching tantrums, and my two-year-old didn't even really throw tantrums. I at the time that my son was young and at the age where he was receiving the childhood vaccines, at the time it was 1990s, there was a lot going around about concern for the side effects of the pertussis part of the DPT vaccine. And so I worried about that, and I consulted with the pediatrician about it, and he said, you know, if you don't want to do it, I will support you. I had to think about it myself, he said. But he said, I've seen professionally a case of whooping cough in the last year, and it's not pretty. So I made the decision at that time to go ahead and do the DPT vaccine. But I gave prophylactic vitamin C and Tylenol and watched him very closely. He sailed through it, not a single problem. The MMR vaccine was different. The first time he had it, he was fussy and feverish for 2 to 3 days. But the second time was when the most severe reaction occurred.
In the second dose of the MMR, he got a high fever, probably somewhere between 104 and 105 degrees. He got out of his head and screamed over and over for me to go out and buy him a dump truck, even though it was the middle of the night and no stores were open. I remember rocking him and singing to him and giving him Tylenol and swabbing his forehead with a cold cloth for hours through the night. And finally in the morning, the fever broke, and I thought, all is well. But the truth is that all was never well again. After this began all of the behavior and social problems. My son was kicked out of three preschools. He was suspended repeatedly and expelled eventually from grade school. It turned out eventually that he was not correctly diagnosed, actually, with his autism till he was nearly 18, because less was known in the 1990s when he was going through grade school in the early 2000s, and it wasn't routinely tested for. We were misdiagnosed with ADHD and other things. Eventually, no schools, alternative or otherwise, could accommodate my son. Even an autism specialist refused to treat him after he threw a flower pot on a BMW from a second floor balcony. His father was financially and behaviorally unsupportive. And as is frequently the case, Jeffrey got much worse during adolescence. 50%, some autistic specialists feel that it's as high as 50% of autistic males at the onset of adolescence get other neurological conditions like epileptic seizures or Tourette's. And so my son began to have these peculiar fits where he would start muttering profane gibberish, his eyes would dilate and dart back and forth, he'd scream racial epithets even though he is not and we are not racist, things about private body parts and sex acts, he would spit at or on people, throw large objects at them, punch holes in walls and damage property, and go after people with punches and kicks. The whole terrible thing would last 4 minutes. Afterward, he would remember nothing except that it happened again. He'd be so remorseful he'd want to die. After my divorce, I came to Hillsboro and bought a building, and I intended to have my chiropractic practice, yoga studio, and residence in the same place, which made sense as a single parent. Basically, as he worsened, he scared my patients and students away, ruined my business, broke holes all over my place, doors, walls, appliances, everything ruined, and basically devastated my life. I lost nearly everything. At 56 years old, I have had to start over, do everything I used to pay people for. My life is very hard, but that pales in relationship to how his life is. He must take 5 psychiatric medications in order to minimally function. He is not able to work. He is totally disabled. He asks me, why did God do this? Why am I like this? He worries about what will happen when his father and I are gone. So this is how my life and my son's life has been affected. As I stated at the beginning of my testimony, I'm not anti-vaccine. I do, however, feel that if there is going to be a law passed that forces parents to provide any and all vaccines, I feel that they should be safe beyond a shadow of a doubt. I will constantly, for the rest of my life, have to live with my doubt about giving the MMR vaccine to my son because of the severe reaction that he had and the changes which happened afterward. Can I prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that the MMR vaccine caused my son's autism? No. But as a mother, I feel that my heart knows. And I think the key is that even as I reflect back, I made that choice. And I just would like to see being able to make that choice preserved for all. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. Senator Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Robert Snee, and I'm an attorney in Portland. I'm here on behalf of myself, behalf of my 2 high school-aged children who both have valid religious exemptions on file. My oldest child is partially vaccinated. My youngest child has not had any vaccinations. I'm not anti-vax. I am pro-informed consent, pro-informed voluntary consent. I'm also here on behalf of the Oregonians for Vaccine Truth and Healthcare Choice. Sadly, the day that Dr. Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, warned us about while speaking at the Constitutional Convention has arrived. He said that the Constitution of this Republic should make special provision for medical freedom. To restrict the art of healing to one class will constitute the Bastille of medical science. All such laws are un-American and despotic. Unless we put medical freedom into the Constitution, the time will come, and as today, when medicine will organize into an undercover dictatorship and force people to submit to only what the dictating outfit offers. The threats to our constitutional rights are all around us, and they're even coming from you, our legislatures. Just as national security is used by the federal government to justify invading the privacy of citizens, the greater good is being used to justify under proposed amendments to Senate Bill 442, infringing upon the religious freedoms and freedom of conscience guaranteed to Oregonians under Oregon's Constitution. There's an organized, orchestrated hysteria pushed by the national media as a result of just over 120 cases of measles, now 140. Interestingly, no deaths have been reported with those measles, and it's the driving force to restrict our individual freedoms. With Time magazine publishing an article calling for the publication of the names and addresses of those who are unvaccinated, the darkness of a new era of McCarthyism has quickly descended upon this country. This nation was founded upon the principles of individual freedom and liberty, and the Bill of Rights were adopted as amendments to the U.S. Constitution and the Oregon Constitution to ensure that government never overreached and trampled upon the rights of individuals. Senate Bill 442, as it's proposed to be amended, it'll trample on those constitutional rights. If passed, it will unethically require forced medical procedures upon those who object because they've taken the time to educate themselves on the true risks of vaccines. We're living in an age of the great denial of vaccine risks and denial of individual freedoms. Because vaccine manufacturers market and sell the only product in the history of this country that is exempt from all liability for design and manufacturing defects, by making vaccines mandatory without any exemptions, people will become nothing more than enslaved consumers of potentially dangerous products marketed by companies that have no economic or legal incentive to improve those products. Mandatory forced vaccination will trample on the foundations of medical ethics, which require fully informed consent to any invasive medical procedure, as well as to scientific experimentation. The first principle of the Nuremberg Code is the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. This means the person is free of coercion and should have sufficient knowledge and comprehension of the elements as to enable him to make an understanding and enlightened decision. The FDA, the CDC, and vaccine makers openly state that often the number of human subjects used in pre-licensing studies are too small to detect rare adverse events, making post-marketing surveillance of new vaccines a de facto scientific experiment. In this regard, the ethical principle of informed consent to vaccination attains even greater importance. Forced vaccinations are different than other medical procedures because they demand in such a way that they demand a greater deference to the ethic of informed consent, not less consideration. Every other medical procedure is an attempt to heal or remedy an already diseased body. Yet vaccinations, by their nature, are taking several known neurotoxins and live biological viruses and injecting them into a previously healthy body in an attempt to create an immune response to protect against the mere potential that the person will be encountered with a targeted disease at some point in their future. While researching this issue, I discovered that the American Medical Association's Code of Ethics specifically recognizes that physicians may claim a religious or philosophical reason not to be immunized. AMA Code of Ethics Opinion Number 9.133. If doctors hold a belief that it's ethical to claim a religious or philosophical exemption to vaccines, under what claim of right does the state have the capability of outlawing ethical behavior by its citizens? Interestingly enough, in an article that was published in the American Academy of Family Physicians, the sponsor of this bill is quoted as disregarding her treating doctor's advice because, in the paraphrase, I did the research and disagreed with her recommendation. She chose to breastfeed her child despite the medication that she was taking for her condition and despite the risk to her child from that medication. There was a greater certainty of...
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I have to interrupt.
Yes, please.
My integrity has just been impugned by the witness, and I want to be really clear here, sir.
I'm not into...
No, sir. Please allow me to respond.
Sure.
Thank you. I appreciate that. My doctor at that time was responding, in fact, to drug company paranoia because they'd never tested it in pregnant and breastfeeding women. I called the national expert on drugs and lactation from the University of Texas and asked him personally to clarify that interferons did not transfer from breast milk, from the mother's tissue into breast milk before I made that decision for my child. And I also was well aware that breastfeeding is the best thing you can do to protect children from autoimmune diseases. So I would be very grateful if you did not take my decision, my personal decision about my medical care, out of context. Thank you.
All right. Please. Remember,
mine was science-based.
We do not... I will have to ask people to leave if we don't have decorum. We do not impugn others. All right?
My statement was not intended in any manner of impugning or maligning the sponsor of this bill, only pointing out that her right to exercise her informed consent and make a different decision than her treating doctor is the same right that we as citizens are seeking for ourselves. Currently, back in 2001, Governor Brown, who was then a senator, at my request introduced Senate Bill 450, which would have provided for a philosophical exemption to vaccines. The health department opposed that bill at that time, testifying and saying that it was unnecessary since philosophical exemptions were protected under the administrative definition of religion. The administration definition of religion at that time included any set of beliefs, practices, or ethical values. That protection is now gone because of the passage of Senate Bill 132, and Senate Bill 442 will further eliminate Oregon's constitutional rights as set forth in Article 1, Section 3, which states freedom of religious opinion, no law in any case shall control the free exercise and enjoyment of religious opinions or interfere with the rights of conscience. If government is allowed to require every citizen to risk injury or death without their voluntary informed consent from a forced medical procedure, then we're no longer free Americans. Excuse me, could I have some water too, please?
I have a pitcher up here.
I didn't need any water.
Cameron, would you please get a pitcher of water and cups and have it at the dais or at the
Once you take away the rights of a parent to make medical decisions based on informed consent for their children, it's only a short step before everyone loses that right to determine what substances are entered into their body, since mandatory adult vaccines are quickly going to follow. Published just last week in the Federal Register for Public Comment is a new National Adult Immunization Plan. The very first line of the introduction to the plan states, despite the availability of, quote, safe and effective vaccines, adult vaccination rates remain low in the United States and far below healthy people 2020 targets. This misstatement of fact and denial of risk in the absence of true vaccine safety studies is astonishing when one considers a mere 29 years ago, the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Act was adopted, acknowledging that vaccine injury or death may be, quote, unavoidable even though the vaccine was properly prepared and accompanied by proper directions and warnings, close quote. There have never been a real-world study of the entire vaccine schedule that is imposed upon our children. Of the 11 separate vaccines given to our children many multiple times, only one vaccine, the MMR, has ever been studied for its relationship to autism. Yet our children get 6 or 7 different vaccines simultaneously at 2, 4, 6, and 12-month doctor appointments. And yet there's still not one study comparing vaccinated children to unvaccinated children. Dr. Russell Blaylock, a neurosurgeon, I'll quote, said, "All of us should be terrified by the totalitarian nature exercised by the proponents of mandatory vaccines. Many are openly calling for not only mandatory vaccinations, but are also hiding critical safety data from the public so as to give the impression of vaccine safety. Programs for mandated eugenics ended when the public realized the true result of such plans. This history is now rarely spoken about, yet present vaccine policies are just as frightening because they hold the potential to irreversibly destroy the lives of millions of children. This bill clearly interferes and burdens the rights of conscience and will violate the Oregon Constitution if it's passed. As citizens, we demand accountability of our government and demand our government protect our rights, not disregard them for the greater good. If it becomes law, then the promises of freedom and liberty that this nation were founded upon are nothing but a sham and an illusion. Welcome to the totalitarian era, for then we are, our bodies, ourselves, and our souls are truly owned by the state.
Can you sum up?
I just did.
Okay, thank you very much.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you very much. Let's go to B.J. Kavner, Joanna Anderson, Dr. Jim Lacey, and Dr. Judith Guzman-Cottrell. And as soon as one is done, then the fourth one can come up.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is B.J. Kavner. I serve as Executive Director for 1 in 4 Chronic Health. We are a collaborative organization to work with all people who are living with chronic health conditions today. And I'm speaking on behalf of our support of the bill, including the Dash 3 amendment. I will limit what I say in the interest of time because I've submitted testimony, written testimony. I just want to speak from a personal perspective. In 2013, I had a cough which wouldn't go away. I saw my doctor thinking it was another type of bronchitis, which is not uncommon for me. And she diagnosed me with pertussis, or whooping cough. I did receive full vaccinations when I was a child, and I've maintained a vaccine schedule as needed as an adult. I was able to recover from pertussis. It took some time. It took not only antibiotics, but cough syrups, corticosteroids, and inhalers. The most frightening aspect of this is that I had earlier in that time frame visited my infant niece in Connecticut, and not to mention flown on a plane there and back. Now, I don't worry about myself, but I worry about what I give to my family and my niece. And we've heard a lot of testimony that's very heartfelt today where people speak of freedoms and totalitarian and issues like this. You know, what about the freedoms of people who aren't able to be vaccinated because they're living with chronic health conditions or they're taking medications that don't allow them to be vaccinated? What about the freedom of the children out there in the public? Don't I have the expectations of freedom for my nieces and nephews to be removed from chronic disease and removed from communicable disease? You know, on behalf of people living with chronic health conditions, I just wanted to say that this is an issue of great concern and very real concern for us. And that's why we support this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Judith Guzman-Cottrell. I'm a pediatric infectious disease specialist at Oregon Health and Science University, where I've been a School of Medicine faculty member since 2004. I also serve as the pediatric medical director of the Infection Prevention and Control Program. I'm an expert in childhood vaccines, and I'm also an expert in managing the diseases that they prevent. And I'm also the mother of two healthy school-age children whose vaccines are up to date. I'm here today to share my and OHSU's support of Senate Bill 442 with the Dash 3 amendments and to encourage your support of this bill as well. If successful, this bill will aid in preserving the health of many Oregonians who do not have the option to vaccinate. In my 13 years at OHSU and as a pediatric infectious disease specialist, I have witnessed significant improvements in life-saving medical advances, such as pediatric cancer therapies, and I work very closely with the oncologist at Dornbecker. Chemotherapy can now actually even cure some childhood cancers. Survival rates have improved for children who undergo bone marrow transplants and solid organ transplants. However, while these children undergo these intensive therapies, which may last years, their immune systems are extremely weak because of their treatments. These children cannot receive protective vaccines, making their patients susceptible to vaccine-preventable diseases that may circulate in their community. And for these children, these diseases are truly life-threatening. I've cared for many of these children. This is the same situation for infants who are too young to receive live virus vaccines, such as MMR and varicella vaccines. Thanks. I want to share just one example of how Oregon's low vaccination rates compared to the rest of our country has impacted our own citizens. As you know, Dornbecker provides cancer care to children all across our state. We had a leukemia patient who I also helped care for, who lived outside of Portland, who was finally, after many, many months of chemotherapy, was finally given medical clearance by his oncologist to go back to school and be with his friends, although it was not yet safe for him to receive live virus vaccines because it was too close to his final chemotherapy regimen. His family and he were so happy that he could finally go back to his classroom. However, within that year, he was exposed to chickenpox at school 3 separate times. After each exposure, his mom would call me, and he would urgently be seen at our hospital to receive an injection of preformed varicella antibodies in goals to attempt to prevent him from becoming infected with the chickenpox varicella virus. Unfortunately, despite the 3rd antibody injection, after that 3rd exposure, he did still develop chickenpox and then subsequently developed varicella pneumonitis, which is a severe pneumonia. He was admitted to our hospital and was very ill, but fortunately he survived. As medical treatments continue to advance and more people survive serious conditions which previously used to kill them, the number of high-risk people in our communities will also increase over time. These are both children and adults with cancer, rheumatologic disease requiring high-dose steroids and other immune suppression, those with HIV, including the patients who I care for across the state, and children who are born with immunodeficiencies. Many of these people cannot be vaccinated. They rely on a highly vaccinated community to protect, and these amendments can help strengthen that safety net. I also have some comments in my written testimony about the increased safety of vaccines. In the interest of time, I'll skip over that because it's already been mentioned. OHSU strongly encourages your support of this bill with the amendments in order to improve vaccination rates in Oregon and to make our communities safer for immune-compromised and youngest Oregonians. And those are the populations who are at highest risk of hospitalization and death from these infectious diseases. Oregon strongly supports your support of this bill, as do I individually. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I briefly amend one thing that I apologize I forgot to include? When I'm speaking of myself, I'm also speaking as a person with a compromised immune system. And so this is not just an exercise in philosophy. This is a very real matter, as the doctor pointed out. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem. I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. I've been here in Salem for 38 years, so I'm even a little bit older than Dr. Bates. So when I was growing up, I too went through the polio epidemic. I had family members that died, actually, from polio. I got measles as a child. My mother told me that. And we had whooping cough and all these infectious diseases growing up. And so to me, these aren't, you know, we're pretend diseases. Vaccines, I remember very distinctly when the first injectable sock vaccine came out, we got shots, and then we got the oral Sabin vaccine, so we got a double whammy of polio vaccines at that time. And then as it got older, we had the tetanus and then diphtheria tetanus vaccines and boosters. So I'm in on the daily forefront of dealing with children that have infectious diseases. In our office, we have children that are immunocompromised. A couple of back notes. I volunteer outside this country, and somebody mentioned East Africa. Tanzania had a huge outbreak of measles up until about 3 years ago, and when I would be going over there, we were dealing with children that had measles. They would die of pneumonia, and they'd die of encephalitis. Those are the two biggies. They went out and vaccinated everybody, and they didn't ask for religious or philosophical exemptions. They have a 99% measles vaccination rate. They're higher than the U.S. They're higher than Oregon. But the only way they did that is they went out into the bush. And these are people that live in mud huts, no water, no electricity, no toilets, nothing. But they went out and vaccinated, and that works. So people that say the vaccines don't work are not well-founded in any kind of science. And it's the vaccine that worked. It wasn't that they improved their hygiene, they improved their food, or anything like that. So it's ironic to me now, if I want to go see measles, I stay here in Salem, Oregon. I'm waiting because we're going to have, and we've had 2 outbreaks since I've been here in Marion County of measles. And so we're going to have measles again. I'm sure it'll come. But if I go to Tanzania, the measles is gone. We have to worry about polio because of Syria, Somalia, all these fractured governments and fractured infrastructures. And so when I'm over there working, we're always talking about, is it polio or not? So I will see polio again, I'm sure, in my lifetime. The thing that we have done in our office is now, because we have parents that come in with small children, parents who have children immunocompromised, in the past we've not actually identified the non-vaccinators or the under-vaccinated. What we've actually had to do for liability issues and also to protect those patients is that if we have a family that's coming in with some kind of infection, we actually identify them. We have them wait in their car. We give them a little pager, and when they're going to come in, they have to put a mask on. We shepherd them in right away, and then we see them for whatever it is. And we just had one with whooping cough last week, and then they go back out again. We have to decontaminate that room for 2 hours. So that's how we're beginning to deal with that. And so we want families to feel safe coming into our office, and the only way we can do that now is to identify the kids that aren't vaccinated. And so we're going out and encouraging them. We deal with vaccines every day in our office. We encourage parents to vaccinate. And we have a form to protect us from liability issues that they have to sign if they don't. But the Senate Bill 442, the -3 amendments, would go to what I think would be the best way to do this, which is to vaccinate everybody. If you're going to use public tax dollars for school, you're going to have to use the public tax dollars for immunizations, and that way we can protect a larger group of the population. So I can go on and on, but I won't. So
thank you very much. Questions? All right. All right, Erica Glancy, Gwendolyn Barlow, and Dave Thomas. And from here on out, I am going to limit you to 3 minutes. And so when the little alarm goes off, that means your time is up. Because we want everyone to be able to testify. And we will stay as late as it takes. Oh, it's Paul. I'm sorry. If you have written material, you give it to the committee assistant, and then he will pass it out. Okay. Please proceed.
Madam Chair and fellow committee members, my name is Erica Glancy. I am a mother of 6 children here in Oregon, 6 beautiful children. And I have 4 that have been fully or partially vaccinated, 2 that have not been fully or have not been vaccinated, and my 2 that have not been vaccinated are my healthiest of all of my 6 children. I have a degree in special education. My husband has a master's degree in mechanical engineering. We are highly educated people. We have chosen in recent years to homeschool our last 4 children, and our other children are attending full-time universities. In the U.S. right now, we have the right to terminate the life of an unborn child. However, the right to choose how we care for that child once it's born is being slowly eliminated. I do not take parenting or the responsibility lightly, and sometimes that conflict in our government today pushes out the discussion or the open conversation for even alternatives or a third option. It's viewed as very black and white. My beliefs to me are not defined simply by my religious affiliation, though I do have one, but also a tenet of my faith, which is to encourages me to follow the promptings or whisperings that I feel directing me one way or another. Forced vaccination would close the discussion and ability for me as a religious person to follow that tenet of my faith. It would force parents to go against their beliefs or lie or pull their children out of any school, private school, or daycare. And it closes the options to even vary the schedule for those immunizations, which I think would have significantly helped my 2 neurologically impaired children. I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I really hope that you will strongly consider that there's an option C and vote no on Senate Bill 442.
Thanks so much for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for this opportunity to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 442.
This is a difficult bill for me. The debate over it boils down to one question. If we're going to convince parents to vaccinate on schedule, do we use persuasion or do we use coercion? What's difficult for me is I am one of those parents that you're trying to reach out to. I vaccinate selectively. I was working constantly with my physician in Idaho, and I feel like when I come with legitimate questions, the state of Oregon is on the cusp of telling me just to shut up and do as I'm told when I have these questions, and this is hard for me. So I want to address some common misperceptions fueling this agenda. First of all, is there a growing trend of parents not vaccinating their children? No, news media is dead wrong on this one. The CDC's own data.
Oh, you forgot to say your name.
Oh, I'm sorry? Yeah. Gwendolyn Barlow, I'm from Beaverton, and I'm representing myself. We didn't see vaccination rates in the 90th percentile until the mid-1990s. I was a third grader in 1985 when the national vaccination rates were 63.5% for DTP, 53.6% for polio, and 61.2% for MMR. These figures account for all doses of each vaccine. Now today, 93.2% of Oregon school children, including my own, enter kindergarten with two doses of the MMR vaccine. Compare that to 86.9% in Kansas, a state with much stricter vaccine exemption laws and a non-medical exemption rate of only 1.8%. So let's talk about these clusters of under-vaccination, because sometimes people learn that, okay, vaccine rates are going up, so let's shift the goalpost of the debate and talk about the clusters. There will inevitably be parents standing up to state coercion, and they are going to homeschool or move. I won't get a hand count today, but I highly doubt you're going to see these parents just drag their kids in for compliance. If all 50 states had the right to conscientious exemptions, there'd be more flexibility in where exempting families could live and work, allowing the 1.8% of non-medically exempting parents to spread out geographically. If you remember nothing else from my testimony, please remember what Dr. Matt Willis, health officer from Marin County, California, told NPR in a recent interview. I quote, "There's little evidence that excluding unvaccinated children from a school where there's no evidence of measles transmission would be an effective public health strategy for limiting the spread of disease." Senators, the rhetoric used to push this bill is no different from the rhetoric used by the United Arab Emirates to justify legally forcing women to breastfeed. I'm a huge proponent of breastfeeding. The personal and public health benefits of breastfeeding are indisputable. But coercing women into breastfeeding, it's as atrocious and dehumanizing as coercing Oregon families into following a single nation's vaccine schedule. And believe me, there's variability in the schedules of different industrialized countries. As a former non-vaccinating parent, I can lay out concrete steps to take. In fact, it is my dream to get everybody into a room and say, here's how you convince me. This is not about my ego. This is not about being right about something. It's about doing what's best for my babies. Coercion is not the answer.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Madam Chair and Senators, I'm Dr. Paul Thomas, pediatrician board certified from Portland, Oregon. I represent 11,000 patients and about 500 new babies each month who come to my practice wanting informed consent about vaccines. It turns out, as a physician, it is my responsibility to give the risks, the benefits, and the alternatives of any medical procedure. We are not going to be allowed to do this if this bill passes the way it's written. And that's a tragedy, because then you might as well eliminate us, the physicians. We are of no value. I'd like you to imagine something. You're about to go into the hospital to have a baby. Maybe it's your daughter's child, so it's your baby or your grandbaby. You sign in to give permission for routine care. That baby's delivered, and within minutes, they get the hepatitis B vaccine and the vitamin K and the eye ointment. Did you know that hepatitis B vaccine contains 250 micrograms of aluminum? That is 10 to 15 times the maximum allowable dose for an infant. You've got the studies in your packet that show brain damage, autism association, and a challenge to the immune system. What makes it worse is the only people that need that vaccine are moms who are positive for Hep B. In Oregon and in this country, that's less than 1%. So we're going to poison the other 99%, and it's going to be mandated by this law, so that we cover that 1%. And our OBGYNs are doing a masterful job. We know who needs the vaccine and who doesn't. What makes this tragic is we now have data, it's in your package, that shows that this policy is not giving lasting immunity. So 15 to 20-year-olds do not have protection anymore when they become sexually active or have IV drug use. We need to change that policy. The JAMA article in February of 2013 in your packet, in Norway, 85,000 pregnancies followed for 6 years. They looked at the autism rate and folate intake. It was 1 in 1,000. The rate here in the United States at the same time was 1 in 100. I was curious, what's the difference? Guess what? They don't give the hepatitis B to newborns who don't need it. Huge difference. In my practice, I now have 1,000 kids who are at least 3 years old, no new autism. At the rate of 1 in 50 that my peers are experiencing, I should have had 20 cases. 4 million births a year in the United States. At a rate of 1 in 50, we have 80,000 cases of autism a year, and it could be reduced by 76,000 by a couple simple measures. Now, you've heard that, oh, it's the MMR is causing the autism and all of that. It's true. The pediatrics article that was quoted in 2004 as showing no link is the very study that had the link. The data was excluded, 300% increase in African-American boys. So the studies are not final. The AAP, my own academy, and the CDC are saying science finished. No, that's not how science works. Science is a process, and the process is unfolding. We need the studies. Look at the group who haven't been vaccinated, the group who are selectively vaccinated, and those who are fully vaccinated, and see what happens. I have a cohort of selectively vaccinated. They all get their DTaP. We're not putting any of these immunocompromised people at risk for pertussis. They're all getting the MMR eventually. Herd immunity is there. We don't need this bill the way it's written. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yes.
I really appreciate your presentation, Doctor, and I'm very serious about this. I'm interested in and by your comment about autism in Norway and stuff like that. I've been doing a little bit of reading because I'm very concerned about this, and believe me, I am not being cavalier about our children's health. My understanding is that Mississippi, which does have a required immunization schedule that includes hepatitis B at birth, has one of the lowest autism rates in the country. Now, I don't know from your perspective whether that's because of underdiagnosis or whether there's another reason. It would be real, and I really mean this very seriously. I'm not being snarky. I'm not trying to cut you out. I'm very serious. Oregon has a very high rate. I think we'll all agree, and that's very concerning to all of us.
Yep.
But Mississippi, which does require this and has a 99.5% rate, has one of the lowest rates in the country. So I'm hoping you can just help me from your perspective understand that.
Sure. Autism is toxins, toxins, toxins. So the first toxins are in the womb, and we all have a body burden, and that burden is going up. Then they're born, bam, 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 the Hep B is another one. There's a genetic predisposition. You've heard of single nucleotide polymorphisms. If you carry the MTHFR, for example, if you're homozygous, you're a lot higher risk to become autistic when exposed to toxins because your detox pathways are compromised. I can't speak specifically to the Mississippi data because I don't know it, but I'm sure it is still way higher than what they experienced in Norway, for example.
I guess I'm just, if I may, Madam Chair, quick follow-up. I guess I'm just a little puzzled because you made the point that the concern about that article in Pediatrics was that they weren't being clear about the data and the risk in African-American males, and Mississippi certainly has a higher percentage of its population that's African-American than us. I'm not asking you to come up with an answer now. You didn't expect to have to answer this, but it is something that I'm curious about.
Sure, that's it just all. Needs to be studied more, for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, panel. I really appreciate you coming. I'm going to jump to Mary Alionis and Jennifer Margulis. And are you Joanna?
Mary.
Oh, okay. And Michael Framson?
Thank you, because we have 5 hours to drive.
Yes, because all of a sudden I said, I better get these people who live more than 100 miles away to testify.
Can we wake up Senator Booth?
Oh, he's awake.
I'm awake.
Can you bring me some water?
Good afternoon. I am Mary Alionis. I'm a farmer. I'm a business owner. And I'm a mom. I've lived in Southern Oregon since 1991. One small comment with regards to discrepancies in autism rates, say in Mississippi versus the Pacific Northwest. Every region has its own toxic load, separate from any load that we add onto it by vaccination or such. We are, for instance, more influenced by mercury-laced rain coming from China than Mississippi is. Each region has its own toxic load. I'm not a scientist, I'm a farmer. But I am aware of toxic loads on all of our bodies from our environment. For the record, I'm science-based. I'm non-religious. I believe in climate change. I don't follow Jenny McCarthy. But this attempt to create compulsory vaccination concerns me for many reasons. To begin, every physician in this room, and likely every lawyer, and likely every parent, knows that vaccines carry risk. The manufacturers acknowledge this. The CDC acknowledges this. The Vaccine Inquiry Injury Compensation Fund was set up to address this. To make this risk appear small or insignificant, I find dishonest. To not present the realities of these risks to the public, I find suspect. To not acknowledge that there may be additional unproven risks, as science is an ever-changing study and it does not rely on facts but on theories, I find that also dishonest. For the past 6 weeks, our country has been in the midst of a media frenzy. A perceived threat has spun to the extent that any and all dissenters are ridiculed, disregarded, demonized, publicly shamed. Very, very little rational, balanced debate has been permitted anywhere. I have heard none in the mainstream media. This is an emotion-based witch hunt. Parents are viewed as not smart enough to make these decisions, with countless condescending slanders put forth. Imagine being a parent of a vaccine-injured child in this climate, to be unable to speak. To attempt to pass this legislation right in the midst of this frenzy comes across as opportunistic and manipulative to me. I'm a goal-oriented person. I run a business. I understand the desire to achieve a goal, in this case, of eliminating disease. We are in the middle of a war on disease, begun in earnest 29 years ago when the Vaccine Injury Compensation Fund was set up. One disease after another is put forth for attempts at elimination, resulting in ever-escalating vaccine schedule. The foot soldiers in this war are our children, and what this amendment would create is a de facto compulsory conscription. Your child in this war, your family will be second-class citizens. But this war has no memorial, no recognition for its little fallen soldiers. In fact, these are hidden. The family's ridiculed if they attempt to tell their story, viewed as a threat to
very
this
much.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Please let me get one. I answered her question to start. Can I please say one more paragraph? I would value it tremendously.
We're trying to get everybody
I
here.
I was answering a question that she
If there's time at the very end, you can finish.
I have one paragraph.
Please.
The most basic human rights in our free and just society is on the verge of being taken away, the right to decide what will be put in our children's vibrant, healthy bodies. Picture having a vaccine-injured child within your genetic line and being forced to vaccinate your child. How tightly would you hug them before each injection? Compulsory vaccination will not solve the vaccination rates. A prioritization of research into which child are most at risk to adverse vaccine reaction and the development of tests to allow physicians and parents to assess an individual child's risk
before
that child is vaccinated
okay.
will do more
All right. you can,
than any
you,
parent.
You can
any
finish at the end of the... All right, thank you very much. You can come at the end to finish up.
So that funny bell that goes off is not someone's cell phone.
Oh, this
that's
is,
our timer.
This is our timer, okay.
Okay, Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Dr. Jennifer Margulis, PhD. I'm an award-winning author and researcher, and I've been writing about issues related to childhood health for over 10 years. I have to tell you, I'm also a very science-minded person. My uncle won a Nobel Prize in physics. My mother was one of the most important evolutionary biologists of the 20th century. My father's a chemist, and I worked on a child survival campaign in West Africa in the 1990s, so I'm probably one of the most vaccinated people in this room. I've had vaccines against diseases that everyone on the committee, but some of us have never even heard existed before. I'm pro-vaccine. I chose to vaccinate my children. I think that vaccines are one of the most important medical interventions of our time. Yet I'm actually here to oppose this bill, and I want to explain why. I don't think that we should be taking away the philosophical and religious exemptions from Oregon parents. And for me, this is not a debate about the efficacy or safety or the merits or the harms of vaccines. It's a debate about freedom and parental choice. And on that science-minded note, we have 3.93 million people in Oregon, and we've had one confirmed case of the measles. That said, I agree that we should be trying as hard as we can to educate parents and encouraging them in every way we can to vaccinate. But there are only two versions of the MMR vaccine available today, and you all know that they both contain human diploid lung fibroblasts, that those are cells that were cultured and grown from a
aborted fetal tissue. I believe that religious parents who do not want to inject their children with aborted fetal tissue cells should have the right to forego those vaccines. You also know, of course, that the three polio vaccines currently on the market, and I lived and worked in a place where polio is endemic and it's a devastating disease. Please don't misunderstand me about that. But that those vaccines contain cells that were grown from African green monkeys. I also believe that parents who are opposed to animal cruelty, who are vegan, should have the right to forego those vaccines for their kids. There have been thousands upon thousands of scientific studies that show that a human baby's immune system benefits tremendously from human breast milk. The number one thing we can do is breastfeed our babies to help their immune systems. We know that breastfed babies have a 20% lower percent of dying than babies who are not, right? But we not breastfeeding, which is a huge crisis in this country, and that's one of the biggest differences with Norway. Norway has almost a 99% breastfeeding initiation rate. Ours is in the 70s. Not breastfeeding is a public health emergency. Given that overwhelming evidence of the positive benefits of breastfeeding, should we legislate that American women breastfeed their babies? Should we exclude any children from school because they have not been breastfed? We know that not breastfeeding compromises their immune system. As far-fetched as that may sound, lawmakers, as somebody else said, in the United Arab Emirates actually threaten women who refuse not to breastfeed with jail time.
We drove for five hours.
One sentence. We care, all of us care in this room about the best. We all care about the same thing. How are we best going to keep our children safe and healthy? But Oregon should be educating parents about vaccines and vaccine safety. There is no place for forced vaccination in a free society.
Thank you. All right, thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Frampson. I'm from Medford, Oregon. I'm a parent. I do not think my son fared well from his vaccines. And I thank you for this opportunity to address the committee. Peter Latham once said, "Truth in all its kind is the most difficult to win, and truth in medicine is the most difficult of all." Just for a moment, can all of those who consider themselves knowledgeable, informed in and out of medicine, say to themselves, "So true"? The problems which plague medicine, medical science, and research, whether it's dysfunctional peer review, dangerous and unnecessary interventions, ghostwriting, conflicts of interest, the revolving door between industry and regulation, clinical trials designed by marketing departments, medical journals which serve their advertisers, primarily the pharmaceutical industry, have created for medical consumers, that's us, an enter-at-your-own-risk system of health and well-being. Yet, parents are asked, in spite of these problems, to believe that the mass vaccination program, one-size-fits-all approach to vaccinating every child in this country with 49 doses of 14 vaccines before the age of 6 is pristine and pure as fallen snow. When parents or anyone questions the methodology of a vaccination study published in a peer-reviewed journal, touted in the media as safe and effective, comparing adverse reactions for a new vaccine versus placebo, and buried in the study is the fact that the placebo, a supposedly biologically inert substance, is yet another experimental vaccine, the pejorative's anti-science, anti-vaccine darts fly. Were similar characterizations applied to those who question the safety of Vioxx, Avandia, FinFin, HRT, or those who questioning the repeated concussions in football, anti-football, or those who recognize there are problems for some with yoga, anti-yoga? In spite of the Hippocratic oath to do no harm, the next Vioxx is likely already being prescribed by physicians. I'm going to abbreviate so we shorten my testimony. Blaming parents and unvaccinated children, for instance, for the recurrent cyclical nature of Bordetella pertussis, whooping cough, infections is scientifically unsupportable. The more likely explanation can be attributable to, one, the temporary short-term immunity as little as 3 years, 2, studies suggesting the natural evolution of B. pertussis, and 3, the misapplied concept of herd immunity. So I'm opposed to any legislation that does not fix the problem. The parents aren't the problem. Fix the problem.
Thank you very much. For those of you that haven't been able to give us your entire testimony, please email them because they can be put in as part of the record. But we're supposed to be out of here by 5, but we're going to hear everybody, and we still have 20-some to go. Okay, let me have Erica, is it Beard, Irvine, and Kendra Pettingill, and is it Joanna Anderson?
Yes.
Please begin, any one of you.
Okay. Hi, my name is Kendra Pettingill, and I came here today from Glide, Oregon. I'm the proud mother of a 16-year-old daughter who also happened to have a severely violent reaction to her vaccines, and 2 years later, she was diagnosed with autism. And no one had ever denied that her reactions weren't from the vaccines. It was quite immediate, and I had even warned our pediatrician that 3 adult members, including myself, while I was in the Air Force, had violent reactions. My mother was contacted by the Red Cross that we'd been given a vaccine. We'd collapsed. We were in the intensive care, and they didn't think we were going to make it. And this happened to 3 immediate siblings. I'm one of 6 children. So despite that warning, he told me he wasn't interested in my silly stories, and it had nothing to do with my child, and that we would do the full schedule as directed, or he would call Children's Services on me. He couldn't have been more wrong. My child reacted just as I had and fought for her life just as valiantly. Really?
I'm so sorry, ma'am, but I have a call about my daughter's health. I really would like to talk to my daughter's doctor.
And please submit your written testimony because she will read it. But please proceed.
Well, since she'll read it, I'll skip the part directly at her. I would say that as a parent, from what I've seen over the last 2 weeks, I've been called a baby killer. I've been told that our children should wear armbands on their arms to be identified. I thought, yeah, a yellow star sounds good. Maybe they can spray paint the front of our businesses too. We've been told that they should give our addresses to the community so that people know where we live, so they can come, I guess, with the pitchforks and the torches. And these were not just from people on social media. These were from Mainline, Time Magazine, and the Washington Post. So this is what we're running into. And I say our children are suffering a lifetime of physical and mental disability, plagued by the oppression from the unharmed majority. So we have an epidemic and a catastrophe health crisis. Measles is not it. Growing up right here in Oregon in a small town and school where everyone knows everyone, I didn't know a single child with asthma, with allergies, none to foods, didn't know anyone with diabetes, behavioral problems, mental problems, ADD, ADHD, didn't know a single child that used an inhaler or had an EpiPen, and I didn't know a single child growing up that took prescription medicines, and especially not for life. I didn't know anyone that comes anywhere near to falling on the autism spectrum. And yet we all had measles, mumps, and chickenpox without issue. I have a chart here that I have included. I really want to say this. It's the rates of disease for Oregon alone. And I got this from a branch of the CDC. And a few I want to name. Developmental delay in Oregon. 21.2% of our children have developmental delay. 8% of our children have autism. ADD and HD, ADHD and ADD, 26.8%. I find this selective hysteria over measles insulting beyond belief that we have an epidemic and it's being ignored. Whenever autism is mentioned, we get crickets. and we have this. They're going to take away our rights because of one case of measles in Oregon.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Yes. Please submit your testimony.
And Madam Chair, yes. If I could just add, I think what you're trying to get at is the reason why we need to keep the testimony concise is that so that everybody has a chance to say their piece.
I know, but all the pro people got to talk for as long as they wanted.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't think that's fair.
I do
all
want
right,
to
please,
say,
the next person, thank
can
you.
Can I say one more thing? That I think what people think is going to happen here, I think she believes she can force us to vaccinate. But I think the educational model already swept in the people that were procrastinators, that were lazy. She's down to the militant Navy SEAL mamas now. We have the vaccine damage kids. And I'm telling you, I will denounce my citizenship and leave the state.
Okay.
I would leave the country, but they are not vaccinating my child.
Thank you very much.
I've made one sacrifice. I've buried one child.
Right now, will the next person please?
It won't happen again.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Good afternoon. My name is Erica Beard Irvin. I'm a pediatrician and homeschooling parent of two from Bend. I'm also prior Navy, so I guess that makes me the Navy SEAL mama. I am here in support of this legislation and in support of tightening non-medical exemptions for vaccinations in Bend. I'm going to cut down my testimony that I had. What I would like to talk about is what I witnessed in terms of children suffering the devastating effects of vaccine-preventable diseases, because those children aren't here to testify. The people who had measles and chickenpox and survived, they're all here. The ones who didn't, they're not. So as a pediatrician, I witnessed firsthand a previously healthy 11-year-old boy died of the flu in the intensive care unit of a children's hospital despite every intervention possible being done for him, including ECMO, which is bypass. Everything was done for him, and we could not save him. And the sound of his mother's sobs through the intensive care unit when they took him off of life support is a sound I will never forget. I took care of a previously healthy 14-year-old girl with pneumococcal sepsis. It's another vaccine-preventable disease, who deteriorated so rapidly in the emergency room despite a very good emergency room team quickly recognizing the seriousness of her illness and mobilizing an ambulance and an ambulance team in 10 minutes. In that 10 minutes, she deteriorated so rapidly that she was too unstable to transfer to a higher level of care, and so she stayed at our hospital overnight. She had two different medications to maintain her blood pressure, and one of my colleagues kept her alive overnight by repeatedly administering epinephrine. She survived. I saw a whooping cough spread through a school. It was they're not kidding with this water. It was actually, it actually got started in the school when a teacher, I'm fine, thank you, when a teacher who had not gotten the adult booster of the DTaP, or TDAP, I'm sorry, was infected with whooping cough, spread it to a few kids in his classroom, a few more kids. There was not a super high exemption rate in this particular school, but it just seemed like everyone who hadn't been immunized, you know, the 11 and 12-year-olds who hadn't gotten their boosters yet, it just seemed like everyone who did get it, and then it just spread. All of the feeder elementary schools, the other middle schools, it was a small military population, and we just crossed our fingers at the end of the school year would get there before any babies got it, and we got lucky, and that happened. I've seen tetanus. I've seen mumps. I've seen chickenpox. I've taken care of a child who had polio as a young baby, before being adopted by an American family, and I saw, you know, what she dealt with the after effects of polio and with her paralysis. These are real diseases. They're out there, and there is real potential for them to get going again. I've taken care of, you know, kids with cancer, kids with abnormal immune systems, and these kids have the right to sit in classrooms and not to be afraid that they're going to be infected with these serious diseases, and that's what we want to ask for the support for with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming.
My name is Joanna Anderson. I'm 73 years old, and I've lived in Oregon since I was 17. Most of those years I lived in northeastern Oregon in a small town at the eastern foot of the Lowell Mountains named Cove. In that town, which I lived, I spent 20 years as the learning specialist in that small town because I served all kids K through 12. In those years, I spent 10 years being responsible for the education of two autistic children. One was moderately autistic, one was severely autistic. I saw these kids daily, and I know all the symptoms of autism. I didn't intend to start. However, I will challenge any parent that says something gave their child autism, unless they can give you objective, empirical data, scientific data, to prove that that child did not have autism at birth. And the only way,
got it,
the only way they can do that is if they have total 24-hour video of that child for a number of years, all the time, to show that that child did not demonstrate autistic tendencies. And the only reason I can say that is I attended a lot of conferences because I had a really tough case, and autism is rare. And my supervisor, I work for the Union Baker County ESD, and my supervisor was very good and supportive, and I was sent to every conference there was that the State Department hosted for autism for all the years I taught those kids, and I also attended some on my own. I personally heard Temple Grandin speak at a conference for 2 days. I sat in the front. I watched her face. I heard every word she said. I recorded every word she said. She is the most authoritative person in the United States that can tell you anything about autism, because she lived it, and she is extremely intelligent, and she can verbalize and do it. Those are my authorities. The other one was watching at a conference. A mother was there with a child about 5 or 6 who thought they only got autism at age 3. However, they had home video of the infant in the bed. And if you know the markers of autism, then you could tell that child was autistic from the time they brought him home from the hospital. Unless anybody can prove that with absolute observational data that cannot be denied, they cannot say what caused autism. Autism is a neurological communication disease. It's awful. It's horrible. I would not want any child to have it. I would not do it in person. I'm here only, and I will speak to other diseases, give you an anecdote about what polio does. I had 3 personal encounters with people. The last one I had, I want to tell you about. We are now finding that children who had polio, when they get into their elder ages, the symptoms are returning. 3 people I know.
Thank you very much.
I will tell you everything else I know about every other. I'm pro-vaccine, but I'm only here to give you personal, anecdotal information that I can back up.
Appreciate
with
it.
Absolute.
Okay. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, especially driving all the long distance that you did too. It means you're really
60 miles
committed.
On I-5 really is not bad.
Yvonne, is it Aileen and
Aileen
and Robert Snee, and is it Jonathan Handy?
Senator, I've already testified. Mr. Robert Snee. I didn't realize I didn't.
Oh, they were on here twice. Okay. And that one's on. Yeah. And then Susan Jory. Jorg. Please proceed, someone.
Hi, I'm Yvonne Aileen. Thank you for having us, Madam Chair, committee. I could have started 1,000 different ways, and I've changed my mind 1,000 times listening to everyone speak. I am speaking in opposition to Senate Bill 442, especially the dash 3. But I want to start with gratitude to Senator Steiner Hayward, because until this moment, I was not an activist, and I am now an activist. Until this moment, I took for granted that I could protect my child and that it was my right to decide how my child was going to be treated medically. I have two children, ages 15 and 16. Samuel was diagnosed with high-functioning autism after his 18-month vaccine round. He is now 15 years old, and he's doing great, and that's through a lot of intervention. I agree with the person who said that this is not autism, but that's what we're having to call it because the medical community does not have another answer for it because it has autism-like symptoms. Autism is a neurological disorder, and there is no such thing as an epidemic genetic occurrence. So this is toxic overload. You have in your packet that I handed out a list from the CDC. It's already been quoted that 30,000 cases of adverse vaccine reactions are reported annually. This is a voluntary, and it's far underreported. 10 to 15% of those are classified as serious, resulting in permanent disability, hospitalization, life-threatening illness, or death. The second page of the report shows all of the goodies that are in our vaccines. The DTaP, I'll just read that one. Aluminum phosphate, formaldehyde, glutaraldehyde, 2-phenofoxinol, Stainer-Schultz medium, modified Mueller's growth medium, modified Mueller casamino acid medium without beef heart infusion, dimethyl 1-beta cyclodextrin, ammonium sulfate. I challenge anyone in this room, doctor or otherwise, to tell me what these ingredients are, to tell me how they will affect my child, to tell me how they will affect my child given his compromised immunity. And if you can do that and make me feel safe, I will vaccinate my child again. But until then, no. I have one other thing I would like to say, and that is, this is a direct quote from Steiner Hayward, Senator Steiner Hayward, on Oregon Live. If your choices affect other people's children, it's not your right to choose. This would affect my child. It's not our right to do that. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Committee, I'm Jonathan Handley. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I have a vaccine-injured son. I wanted to ask Senator Steiner Hayward, how many vaccines out of the 37 given by the age of 6 have we studied for their relationship to autism?
Can't give you a precise answer to that, sir.
Okay. You said that until you've done the valid research on this, you just have to say, yeah, don't think it's the right thing for my kid. So you haven't done the valid research, but I have. I'm a Stanford graduate, honors. So is my wife. She was a valedictorian at Lincoln High School. Two shots out of 37 have been looked at for the relationship to autism, both MMR shots. No other shots have been looked at. No other shots have been looked at. I've studied this issue for 10 years. I'm more versed on this issue than you are. You said that Andrew Wakefield had recanted. It's in the press. You said it. That's not true. So who are you to sit there and tell us?
We need to depersonalize this testimony.
Yeah, we can't impugn.
Why don't you just give your testimony?
Take a step back.
Yeah.
Let's talk about autism. 30 years ago, tobacco. They found doctors everywhere who said, oh, there's no relationship between tobacco and lung cancer. That's where we are today. It's the worst possible time to put the jackboot on the neck of parents. Here's what we know. Tens of thousands of parents saying exactly the same thing. We've all had the same experience. If you look at the adverse reaction from MMR, encephalopathy, brain damage, it's not that hard to figure out what happened. I watched it happen to my son, okay? Here's the next thing. There's two forms of studies that matter. There's the Danish studies that focus on mercury, and Paul Thorsen is now a wanted fugitive. He's the primary study author. Look it up. He's wanted for stealing money from the CDC. Just Google Atlanta Attorney General. Paul Thorsen wanted, stole $2 million. The second theory is MMR. William Thompson, CDC whistleblower. To answer Senator Steiner Hayward's question earlier, what Thompson alleges is that giving MMR earlier to African-American boys triggered a 4 times higher rate of autism. So Hep B is not consequential at all to what Thompson is alleging. He's now a protected whistleblower. You are picking the worst possible time in a highly contested issue to put a jackboot on parents' necks and forcing them to vaccinate when there's so much unknown. And 1 in 68 children have autism. And what do we say? We don't know what causes it, but we know it can't be vaccines. No, why? Because tens of thousands of parents are wrong. Bernard Rimland, PhD, who spent his entire life studying autism, who had a son with autism, said the autism epidemic is real. We had to spend years just proving it was real. They tried to tell us it was better diagnosis. And excessive vaccinations are the cause. Bernie Rimland, 2003. Thank you very much. That's the end of my testimony.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Chair Mons, Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Susan Jorg of Estacada, Oregon, and I am a representative of the Oregons for Vaccine Truth and Health Care Choice with over 1,000 subscribers. I oppose Bill 442, especially Extension C, is it?
Yes. Amendment 3.
Amendment 3, excuse me. Because I feel we need to stop medical mandates, not strengthen them. We are told again and again that vaccines are safe and effective. If parents felt that was true, they would gladly line up. But they can easily find information from very reliable sources that show that that is not the case. For one thing, the pharmaceutical companies have no liability for their vaccines. The government was so nice to take that away from them. So why do you think they have any incentive to make their vaccines safe if they have no liability? They're just reaping in the profits. Also, you should consider that 83% of vaccines are manufactured in China. Are you comfortable with that? What if relationships with China change? They could easily slip any sort of biological warfare agent into those vaccines and kill us all instantly. Also, I listen more to the Japanese government than our U.S. because the MMR vaccine has been banned in Japan since 1993 after a record number of non-viral meningitis and other adverse reactions to that vaccine. The expected rate was 2,000 times higher than the expected rate, these adverse reactions. Also, Oregon should not be in a rush to join Mississippi, as it is now. The U.S. is the most highly vaccinated nation in the world, yet there are 33 countries that have lower infant mortality rates than the U.S. And sadly, Mississippi has the highest infant mortality rate in the county, in the country, excuse me. I respect Brian Hooker, who is a PhD in bioengineering, whose son is vaccine damaged. Excuse me. Can I say my last? The allopathic medicine, is allopathic medicine dying a slow death? Are doctors, politicians, and bureaucrats working frantically to shore up and force people into medical procedures? It's been said if you have a vaccination policy in this country that mandates, which takes away your children, which puts you at gunpoint, which puts parents in prison for not vaccinating, that is not built on public trust and confidence. That is a disaster. Public health policy and vaccination policy requires the confidence of the public,
and we
have lost it.
Thank you so much, all of you. Nora Brock, Michael King, Sandra Ganey.
I'll go. Are there germs on this cup?
Please proceed.
Okay. Senators, thank you for your time. I'm Sandra Ganey of Portland. I'm representing myself. I'm opposed to restricting vaccination choice and trying to tie it to a child's education. We are free to vaccinate, and we should all remain free to decline. To mandate vaccines is to tell parents we must risk injury or death of our child, however small, then deprive us in this country of legal recourse if something goes wrong. The religious exemption is guaranteed by the Constitution. You are bullying us and attacking our civil liberties. If you care about Oregon's children, which you claim, you should first fix the 25% poverty rate in this state because malnourished children are the first to get sick.
Health does not come from an injection. Even Senator Hayward said herself, quote, you can't fix everything with pills and procedures. In your packet I gave you, I'll just list what I have here. This is a list of 97 research papers, published research linking vaccines with autism, 97. This is an published peer-reviewed, 80 references about SIDS. 80% of all SIDS cases, sudden infant death syndrome, occur within 10 days of vaccination. SIDS is the third leading cause of infant death in Oregon. This is 280 references about live vaccine shedding, which nobody has talked about. And if you will take a friendly amendment to this bill, I would add that any child that is freshly vaccinated should be excluded from school from 2 to 4 weeks because of live vaccine shedding. You can't say it's not real. Here's 280 references. This is a list of year-to-date 2015 injuries and deaths of vaccines in this country. At measles, we have MMR, 57 deaths year-to-date from the MMR, so we have more deaths. This is from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services Vaccine Adverse Reaction Database, more than actually have died from the disease. This is from China, communist country, no choice, 99.9% vaccinated, measles outbreaks every single year. How's that herd immunity working for you? This is, was mentioned before, two federal lawsuits in process about Merck falsifying data on the MMR. How can we possibly move forward and make more people get this thing when we have court cases in process? Shouldn't we wait and see how those play out and the evidence that comes forward in these cases? Also mentioned Dr. William Thompson, PhD, CDC, about the omitted data that clearly showed 300% increase in autism from the MMR. And here we have a picture of the fugitive, Dr. Paul Thorson, for 13 counts fraud and money laundering, diverting $1 million of CDC grant money to his own accounts. This is the man whose research says autism and vaccines aren't related.
Thank you. The man
who's in Denmark.
Thank you so much.
China has fined GlaxoSmithKline $490 million after a court found it guilty of bribing doctors and hospitals.
Okay, and you can submit. You were wonderful in giving us this written
mandates
testimony.
Mandates for
so
vaccines
thank you very
by
much.
Legislatures, de facto
would you please
practice
remove her?
Of medicine
yes.
without a license.
You need
and the
to leave.
AMAs.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All done.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, Madam Chairperson, Ms. Menez Anderson, and members of the committee, my name is Nora Brock. I'm here to voice my opposition to Senate Bill 442. I have come to testify to the suffering my grandson has endured because of blind trust in pharmaceutical products and those who administer them. My grandson received approximately 22 vaccines by the time he was 1 year old. In contrast, my own children received 10 by the time they entered first grade. Vaccines are a drug with possible lethal side effects. There is no consideration to size, weight, or age when they are administered. Oftentimes, they are given in combination, yet there has been no study to date that explores any possible issues with administering numerous vaccines at one time to one child. In good conscience, no one can possibly say that vaccines are without any dangers. The Supreme Court called vaccines unavoidably unsafe. Our family has witnessed a tragedy, and we are denied the truth. We are ridiculed, we are ostracized by the medical community, and called names like anti-vaxxers. All these slurs are used in an effort to dehumanize us. It is always easier to inflict injustice when you portray the victim as a rube. It is not enough that we exist in an upturned world with a vaccine-injured child. For example, a planned zoo trip visit just this week lasted only an hour. That was the extent to which my grandson could endure the zoo. The whole time I pushed him in a bicycle cart, a 9-year-old, because he cannot walk for any length of time. This is our vaccine truth. He received a vaccine called ProQuad by Merck. ProQuad was a 4-in-1 vaccine. It contained MMR with varicella. It was taken off the CDC list in 2010 after Kaiser did a study and determined it had increased risk of febrile seizures. Unfortunately, my grandson got the vaccine in 2007 when he was 1 year. He was spinning in circles within a week of being given the vaccine. We now know that he was having seizures. By the time, we had no clue. He became very ill. His face looked as if he had a stroke. He was drooling, and this former normally engaging child no longer cared to look at us. He was plagued by diarrhea. His mother took him back to the doctor, and the doctor ordered a blood draw. But because of the doctor's incompetence, she also convinced his mother to give him three more vaccines the same day that he received the blood draw. This is when all hell broke loose. Here is where the truth gets dirty. That blood draw taken from my grandson on the day they gave him three more vaccines, it showed he had only 3% neutrophils and 93% lymphocytes. He was severely immune compromised. His absolute count of neutrophils was 327. He should have been hospitalized. He developed a pale optic nerve, a sign he was going blind in his left eye. His head circumference jumped from 75 percentile to 95 percentile at 18 months, a sign of encephalitis. His skin color lightened in spots as he developed vitiligo. Asthma had been diagnosed at, he had been diagnosed with asthma at 6 months. That increased. He suffered from hypotonia. He had a positive anti-nuclear antibody test, which is associated with lupus. And the diarrhea would not stop. And he lost his language. All 40 of his words disappeared, along with our happy grandson. Please, let me continue with this.
And you cannot
let me tell this story. This is not right. And you know what happened next to my grandson, but a benevolent medical system that treated him, they did not tell his parents any of it. They sent his young mother home with a very sick child. There was no alerting to her ongoing blood condition or his ongoing blood condition. Oh, they followed up on the pale nerve and sent him to a childhood ophthalmologist. She never mentioned the pale optic nerve to his parents and began a treatment for lazy eye, dulling his good eye, putting him in glasses, and essentially sending him out with blind in both eyes.
That's tragic.
It was only after we saw his medical records that his two aunts, one a dentist and the other a biochemist with a degree in medical laboratory science, both evaluated his records and could not believe what they found. My dentist daughter took it upon herself to prove that he indeed had a pale optic nerve and spoke to the specialist at KCI
Institute.
Thank
you very much.
It was through my daughter's insistence that a surgery took place to verify that his parents had not been told.
Yes.
Then we spent weeks trying to figure out what infections had caused all this to happen.
All right. We'll have to ask you. You need to just submit your, and thank you for sharing that story.
I will be sharing this with others.
Yes,
too.
And please give it to the administration.
So I've already sent it to you in an email.
Yeah, well, then we have it in our OLA system. Thank you.
Chairwoman Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Michael King. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I'm a registered nurse. I oppose any changes to SB 422 that restrict philosophical and religious exemptions. I stand before you not just as a medical professional, but as someone who's been vaccine injured and almost died, meaning stopped breathing as a result. Thank God my godmother, who was a nurse, was present at the time. I am alive and well today. I'll discuss vaccine ingredients, review current Oregon statutes, and further discuss human rights regarding the bill. I know I have 3 minutes. It used to be 5 minutes. I will try and keep it as short as I can. Combination vaccine PDRx made by GlaxoSmithKline. All of their information is available online. You get 3 doses by 6 months of age, aluminum, a heavy metal without which the vaccine would not work, approximately 850 micrograms of aluminum in each of those 3 doses. 10 to 20 micrograms is the toxic dose for somebody in that age range. That is 42.5 times, that's minimum, the toxic dose in one shot. Additive effects equal 127 times the toxic dose by 6 months of age. Third grade math shows this is not only medically irresponsible, it verges on malpractice. I'm clearly not even certain why it's illegal in the United States of America. Significant risks of aluminum toxicity, anemia, osteomalacia, directly targets the nervous system, causing dysfunction with the neurotransmitter acetylcholine, so all sorts of neurologic effects as a result, decreases glomerular filtration rate, renal blood flow in infants causing kidney damage, and also decreased renal function equals decreased excretion rate of said toxins. PDRx contains also 100 micrograms of formaldehyde, potential carcinogen, and neurotoxin, according to the CDC. It's so in the workplace, it's supposed to be handled with proper ventilation and a safety hood, but apparently we're okay with injecting that into the soft tissue of our little children. In regards to the idea that vaccines work, Flulaval in 2013 had on the insert second paragraph that it's never actually been tested on a live population to see if it works. Conveniently, the 2014 insert was that line was taken off. I do read the inserts. I'm a very good nurse. As a nurse, the right of patient to refuse any medication or treatment for any reason is paramount. There are current standards that exist in Oregon law. I refer you to Oregon Administrative Rule 291, Division 64. This regards the informed consent to treatment with psychotropic medications for inmates. I suggest that as you all, and I know you will, as you review this, I ask that you review this administrative rule. If for some unfortunate reason you do pass this bill with this recommendations, that if it's compulsory, the law-abiding citizens deserve at minimum the same treatment as our inmates. To spell it out, each individual case gets two separate visions. You can read the bill, but the point is ultimately to follow any other procedure would be not only medical negligence, it would actually be staggering cost-wise. I don't think Oregon's prepared for the cost associated with following its current laws if this bill passes. I would be shocked also if it ever passed an ethics board. In short, mandatory vaccination in the name of safety is unacceptable. Really, you could compare it to rape of another kind. I don't mean to discount anybody else who has been physically raped. I don't mean that at all. I'm simply saying this is another form of body rape. Ultimately, I'm 31. I'll have to live with the decisions of this committee for the next 60-plus years. I will not sit silently as we watch our children get injected with known toxins. Vaccines have known toxins. We have the risk of diseases and nutrition and hygiene help. In closing, I ask that you strike down any part of this bill that infringes on our religious or philosophical rights to decide medical treatment, leaving the current fair and balanced option for informed consent module in place. Thank you for your time. Can I say one more thing? It's literally one sentence.
Thank you very much.
Can I say one sentence, please?
And you can add it to your testimony and give it to
the It's specifically Ms. Hayward. It's important, ma'am.
You can speak with her after the
Okay. It's an apology, actually.
Yeah.
Either way, I just
you can send.
I'll talk to you later, ma'am. But it's important, and I want you to know I do care.
Thank you,
Katie Sperry, Darcy Raposa, and David Sawyer. Okay, Katie Sperry. Okay, she's not here. Darcy Raposa.
That's me.
Okay, David Sawyer. Not here. Jennifer Trevilli. Jennifer Trevilli. Jennifer Trevilli. Katie Sperry.
Spurley.
Yes. Okay. And Desiree Lafave. Okay. Nicole Jackson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Darcy Raposa. I live here in Salem, and I'm here today representing my family. I'm testifying today in strong opposition to SB 442 as amended that would remove the non-medical vaccine exemption. You already have my written testimony. I implore you today to consider the ramifications of this amendment. By removing this exemption, we are saying that we are okay with any future vaccine that the government requires, sight unseen, in perpetuity. Perhaps you're okay with today's required shots, but are you absolutely certain you'll still be okay with it in 5, 10, 20 years from now? There's hundreds of vaccines in development, including for various STDs. Are you okay with your child being forced to be vaccinated for an STD in order to attend school? No. If the non-medical exemption is taken away, too bad. Lest we think that those types of vaccinations would never be required for school attendance, right now, New York State Legislature has bills in their bills in both houses of the legislature which would mandate the HPV vaccine, a virus primarily transmitted as an STD, for all sixth graders. We simply cannot predict what future requirements will be. There's been a lot of talk today about immunocompromised children and the dangers that unvaccinated kids pose. But they're also at risk by a person recently vaccinated with varicella, MMR, rotavirus, and shingles, and the live influenza virus that shed for weeks afterwards. Oregonians are fiercely proud of our civil liberties. This amendment would put us on par with Mississippi and West Virginia. And by the way, Mississippi ranks 50th in infant mortality rates. Taking away a person's right to decline a medical procedure, particularly one that carries inherent risk of injury or death, and one for which the manufacturer can't even be held liable, all in the name of the greater good, puts us on an extremely slippery slope. Please stand up for the freedom of Oregon parents to continue to make medical decisions for their children without having to compromise a quality education for them.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
I hate these things. My name is Katie Spurley. I am a mother of two. I have spent years researching this topic ahead of way ahead of Google before it was popular. I chose not to vaccinate my children because of the information that I found for myself. And so I have two very healthy, unvaccinated children, ages 8 and 11. Neither of them have ever needed antibiotics for anything at their ages that they currently are. Neither of them have ever missed more than 2 or 3 days of school in one given year. I'm sorry, I had to kind of cut things out because other people have already said it. One of the arguments that I've heard is that non-vaxxers are uneducated. And one of the things that I have to say to that is people that are not educated about vaccines don't even know that an exemption exists. They just do what their doctors tell them to do and they go on their merry way. If you believe that the vaccines work, then why are you so worried about my children? I personally have had a vaccine injury, which is what prompted my research years ago. I had those same injuries and reactions when I was a child, but they were not attributed to the vaccine. When I was 18, I was strong-armed into having some booster shots and also getting the hepatitis B vaccine. And it basically resulted in me being chronically ill for about 10 years. And then I ended up, it just crashed my immune system to the point where I was sick almost every single month until I finally, at 29 years old, had my tonsils removed. I guess the point that I want to make today, and I don't need to, you know, keep going, there's a lot of people that have said things that I already know. If this passes, I will not vaccinate my children. You will not strong-arm me into vaccinating my kids. You will strong-arm me into finding another education path for them. And that will not be including injecting them with toxic chemicals.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Jackson. It has been a long and emotional day, and I have removed a bunch of the data that I wanted to talk about because it's already been discussed. But I will tell a personal story because I think a lot of the personal stories that you've been hearing today were from people that were concerned about the risks of vaccine. I'd like to tell a personal story about the risks of disease. My own mother had polio. On my wedding day, I was given a photo album by my aunt, her sister, that had a picture of my mother in a wheelchair at about the age of 8 or 9. She had polio. There was no vaccine available at the time. Even though she was only 8 or 9, she remembers very vividly what it was like because this was a severe outbreak where she was. She talks about having hallways in the hospital full of cribs with babies. Now, obviously, because I'm here today, she survived. She was one of the fortunate ones. She survived, but a lot of people didn't. She went on to become a registered nurse. She saw in her work, in her career, she saw the ravages of disease. She saw tetanus. Now, tetanus is not communicable, but it is vaccine preventable. She saw the results of and cared for the results of polio, measles, things like that. I called her before I came to this hearing to talk to her, just to ask her permission to tell this story, to give a personal story of someone who lived in that era. And I asked her, did you vaccinate me? Did you vaccinate all of my siblings? Her answer was, of course. When those vaccines became available, people who had lived through those diseases gave them to their children because they knew, they had seen what happens when the diseases are not prevented. Now, memories are short. In just one generation, I went to medical school. I graduated in 2000. During medical school, I learned about polio, but I didn't think that I was going to be treating it unless I left the United States. Now, I've decided not to practice medicine. I'm staying home, but my husband does practice medicine. He's a pediatrician. I am concerned that during his career, he will be seeing a resurgence of these vaccine-preventable diseases. And therefore, I just want to speak in support of Senate Bill 442 with the dash 3 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. All right. Is Jennifer Trevelli not here? Okay, come up. And then Nicole Jackson, is that who you were? Yeah. Yes. Ann Durante? Ann Durante,
she's
not here?
Room.
What?
She's in the other room.
Well, if she can come. Michelle Cook? Sarah Soltani? Okay. Yeah. For the people watching in the other room, we do have seats here if you want to migrate into this room. Please proceed.
Chair and committee members, when I reflected on what I could offer
Name to first.
Oh, sorry, Jennifer Trevelli of Salem, Oregon. When I reflected on what I could offer this committee, I came to a focus point on some information that I actually shared with a group of elementary students this morning. And that is about what is happening on a larger scale here with our brains. So neurobiology has shown us that there are actually two distinctly separate regions of our brain. One can be called the protector brain that assesses threat for survival purposes. The other area, the higher regions, can be called the wise mind. And what that does is allows us to make decisions that are informed and wise and use all of the information available to us. I think that we've seen over all the testimonies today and all of the things being thrown out that this particular bill is activating the protector brains of a lot of people. So what I would like to offer is I would just respectfully request that each of you sit with all of the information that you've been given and truly assess for yourself whether the thoughts that you're having about this bill passing or not are from a place of fear or from a place of a rational, wise mind, a place of peace within that feels like a fully informed decision. That being said, I also would like to add that I have yet to hear during this entire testimony process a direct statement about how this bill specifically will address and impact directly the emergency that we are calling this measles outbreak. And that's all. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Chair, Madam. And, oh, I was way too close. Sorry. My name is Sarah Soltani, and I come before you today as the mother and representing my family and others in Washington County. I would first like to read the following from Progress in Health Sciences, Volume 2, from 2012. Neurologic Adverse Events Following Vaccination. Conclusions. Despite the assurances of the necessity and safety of vaccinations, there are more and more questions and doubts which both physicians and parents are waiting to be clarified. It seems that it would be worthwhile to apply the precautionary principle. The ethical principle, according to which if there is probable, although poorly known, risk of adverse effects of new technology, it is better not to implement it rather than to risk uncertain but potentially very harmful consequences. Sorry, I have to skip over so much because it's already been covered. There was testimony earlier that we did get thimerosal removed, and I'd like to say that that is not the case. It is still in flu vaccines as well as several others, and that is affecting our children because the flu vax is on the schedule for 6 months, as early as 6 months of age. The vaccine schedule has increased 17 times from the 1950s to the present, from 4 vaccinations to 68. We are the most vaccinated country in the world, yet per the CIA's own stats, and sorry, this conflicts with someone else's earlier, 55 other countries, including Japan, Norway, and Sweden, have lower infant mortality rates than the U.S. Mississippi being, let's see, as of September 29, 2014, the Washington Post stated that Mississippi, with its infant death rates of 9.6 per thousand, is comparable to Botswana. That's in the U.S. That's insane. Why are we stigmatizing intelligent parents who know their family risk factors and choose not to give certain vaccines? For example, mitochondrial issues and genetic glitches like the MTHFR gene are now found in over 30% of the population. It's expected to be much higher than that. These children and adults are susceptible to damage and injury from vaccines, yet we aren't testing prior to administering them. These tests aren't expensive. They're $99 for a layman. I'm sure it's much cheaper through medical if it was covered. This bill that I oppose is in direct violation to my constitutional rights by removing religious exemptions. If you're going to remove them, or if you're going to remove exemptions, I suggest you remove the legislation from the National Vaccine Injury Act of 1986. It took all the liability out of the manufacturer's hands, as well as any incentive to make vaccines safer and more effective. Insurance companies grade physician quality on quality measures, and one of the quality measures pediatricians are graded on is their immunization rate. This puts pressure on pediatricians to get patients to comply with the CDC schedule, thus acting as an arm of Big Pharma. Could I read one more sentence? At her tenure as director of the CDC, Julie Gerberding nearly doubled the doses. She then went on to become and is currently president of Merck's vaccine unit, a $5 billion a year operation that makes 14 of the 17 vaccines that the CDC recommends for children. This is a huge conflict of interest. I hope you take this into consideration. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Hi, my name is Michelle Cook, and I am here on behalf of a woman named Karen Kane, who was unable to be here. And then I'll also say a little bit on my own if I have time. But she had a daughter, Lauren, who was vaccine injured on April 27th, 1994. On the morning of April 27th, I'll read it from her perspective. I was holding Lauren, and she looked up at me and gave me the biggest smile. I had no idea that this would be my first and last smile for a long time. That day, I took Lauren in for her well baby checkup. Lauren received a DPT vaccine. She then fell into a deep sleep. 2 hours later, she woke screaming and shaking. I held her in my arms as far as possible away from me as her tiny body shook. This lasted for 5 minutes. Now I was afraid of my new baby. I took her back to the pediatrician's office, and during the exam, she did it in front of the doctor, also lasting 5 minutes. I was told that Lauren was having a seizure, and she sent me to the hospital. This day changed my life forever. 14 days later, Lauren had her third seizure, and by May 9th, she had had 9 5-minute seizures in one day, which left her body lifeless. My Lauren was getting worse every day. At 4 months of age, she was taking 3 different anti-seizure medications. I was told that sometimes babies have seizures, but generally they grow out of them. Well, the one good thing that came out from this visit was the conversation with a CDC specialist. This doctor told us that Lauren was having a typical vaccine reaction to the DPT. This surprised us, as doctors would not discuss Lauren's vaccine injury. In this time, we learned that Lauren received what is called a hot lot. That means that 30 kids had seizures or worse reported with the same lot that Lauren had had. There were also 10 surrounding deaths. It is important to mention here that the drug companies back then, and still do today, scattered the lots when mailing them to the doctor's offices. Lauren's lot was scattered all over the United States so that the same doctor would not see all the vaccine reactions. This is legal and approved by our government. I'm skipping over some things so that save time. This was a time before the internet. I was isolated and alone. My only hope was that the National Vaccine Compensation Program would step in and help us. The fact that they agreed the cause of injury was vaccine related was great. The next step was to decide how much money should be given to Lauren to help her for the rest of her life. I was very afraid for her. The first time I met the team from the NVCP was at Cedars-Sinai. Lauren was in the hospital as usual for uncontrolled seizures. I waited with great anticipation. Everything was taking too long. Every day she was alive, she was another day behind. She was making no childhood gains, and anything she did was lost immediately with her constant seizures and drug changes. Dr. Menkes, who wrote the book The Doctor's Study to Become a Doctor, told me she was one of the worst seizure cases he had treated. Skipping a bunch more. So parents need to understand and educate themselves on some very important facts. Vaccines are made with aborted fetal tissue, which contains human DNA, which, you know, to me is a religious exemption right there. Aluminum, mercury, formaldehyde, and MSG. Current vaccine schedule requires up to 9 vaccines at once, including the flu shot, da 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 da. And you've already had all that stuff. But
The U.S. has the highest vaccine schedule and one of the highest infant mortality rates. We fall behind 33 other developed nations regarding infant mortality. We are ranked 78 behind 78 other nations for infants who die within the first 24 hours of life. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Thank you very much.
Going at all.
And you can submit your written testimony to Karen.
Okay.
And get it on.
I just want to say one thing. I'm a grocery label reader, and I've read the vaccine labels, and I would not have my children eat those things, more, much less inject them.
Thank you so much. All right. With that, I want to ask Desiree LaFave. Okay. Yeah, she is here. And was there another name I called?
Andrant.
Okay, come on up. Yeah, Andrant. And then is it Vishisha Adams? Adamson? Vieira Adams? Visha. Okay, please come. Okay.
I'm Andrant. I'm a chiropractor. I am desperately trying to cover things that I have here that maybe haven't been covered yet. The aluminum adjuvants in vaccines were already mentioned by a nurse that testified earlier. State Health Department ensures us in their information that aluminum is perfectly safe. You'll find it in breast milk and in formula. The GI tract filters out 99.7% of aluminum that goes through that tract. So injecting it is a little bit different. Because infants, it's a known neurotoxin. Infants do not have a mature blood-brain barrier. They can't excrete it. That's why infant IVs are filtered down. It's filtered out as a contaminant to a goal level of 10 micrograms, depending on the size of the baby, up to 26 micrograms of aluminum. We're delivering 250 milligrams right at birth in a Hep B vaccine. And from 175, 200, up to 600 and some Tdap vaccines from there on in, all at once. Part of the reason that aluminum is in the vaccine is to, the main reason is to stimulate the immune system. It's called an adjuvant. Another factor we might consider with autoimmune and neurological disease is that babies are born you could say immunodeficient. It has been looked at that way. Sometimes it's called an anti-inflammatory phenotype. It means their immune system does not mount a strong response to invading microbes. It does make them more vulnerable to infection. It also makes it harder to get a vaccine to work because they don't respond very strongly to it. So we add aluminum. This was considered a flaw. Recently, it's been revisited, looked at in a different light. It's found that in all mammals, a strong immune response is not elicited. Babies rely on their mother's antibodies and their mother's milk for immune protection. Why is that? Because during a time of tremendous tissue growth and remodeling, as the baby is growing and developing, it's simultaneously developing an immune system that's maturing to learn what is self and what is not self. So it learns not to attack self, and after it's born, to get programmed not to attack all the microbes that it's going to be exposed to, many of them very healthy, and not to react to all the proteins that it comes in contact with either. So it's very protective of autoimmunity and of overreaction to proteins and that are in the environment. I'd like to say one last thing that was touched on already. Pertussis outbreaks were a big part of the reason for 2 years ago Senate Bill 132, and I still hear it being talked about today. The increase in pertussis, it is cyclical, but there was a worldwide increase of outbreaks in pertussis around 2011, 12, 13. At that same time, New England Journal of Medicine and other sources reported that one of the big problems is that the Tdap vaccine was not, the effects of it were not lasting. After the fifth dose.
Okay, thank you. You need to sum up real quick.
Okay. Fifth dose, there was waning immunity within 1 year of 48%. Secondly, when it was found that the species of pertussis bacterium had mutated to escape that vaccine, in Australia, it started out to be up to 2007, about 30% of pertussis had mutated from the vaccine. By 2016, 85% of the strains there were not vaccine covered. The mutation happened in the part of the bacteria that the vaccine affects. In the United States, 12 cases were checked in eastern United States.
You need to
breakout. 11 of 12 not affected by the vaccine.
Thank you.
So let's talk about vaccine failure there, not about kids that aren't vaccinated.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and other committee members, my name is Visha Adamson, and I'm here in Marion County. I just wanted to talk about my opposition to Senate Bill 442, because I also have done a lot of research, as a lot of people here have. And one thing that has been only gleaned upon twice now is the fetal cells that the vaccinations are made from. This is a huge religious problem for some people who are against abortions and the use of aborted fetal cells. And if this is to pass, then that means that people have to go over their religious exemptions and religious firmly held beliefs that this is not a good thing in order to vaccinate their children. I personally, in my faith, I found out about how the vaccinations were made, and it was very scary to me to not vaccinate my children. It has been something that I have had to grow in strength and trust in order to not vaccinate my children for these things. But it is so imperative to me that we have these. I gave you guys a packet, and in there I show that there are ethical versions made in other countries for a lot of the vaccinations that we have in this country. But our government, pharmaceutical companies, whoever, aren't going to allow them into the country. The MMR, the rubella, is the only one that's made from fetal cells. If we were to separate the measles and the mumps, there are people like myself who would give my children the measles and the mumps vaccinations were they separate. But it was back in, I believe, like 1992 that Merck said that they all had to be put together, and therefore I have an issue with giving my children DNA from another child. There were also 27 babies that were killed just to make the rubella vaccination. This is a huge ethical dilemma. And to say that we should not have a right to say we don't want our children to be a part of this is, I believe, a very big freedom issue.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you. Hello, I'm Desiree LaFave, and I'm here actually. I have lots of feelings about this issue. I'm speaking against this, and I'm here mostly because so many things have been articulated well to tell you about my daughter, Marin, who's 11 years old. She's a child who has waffled back and forth between fairly healthy to quite the opposite. Her history of conditions and symptoms have included high heavy metals, cardiac muscle wasting enzymes, acute kidney failure, and many neurologic symptoms that never go away. She is positive for the MTHFR gene mutation, A1298C. She has a heterozygous copy. People think it's not why she has medical problems, but her treatments actually have changed that her condition quite a lot. And people with MTHFR actually don't methylate properly, and they don't actually get rid of heavy metals, which is why she has heavy metals. Marin's parents and doctors have tried for greater than 10 years to find a diagnosis for her, to no avail. Last year, when I asked her neurologist how often kids go undiagnosed, she answered more than 50% of the time.
For a child that has no diagnosis, I feel a lot of concern about giving her vaccinations due to the potential insult to her system. She would end up potentially back in the situation that she was recently in, which was having to be in a wheelchair to go to the zoo or the mall or even Fred Meyer at times. You might feel that my child would have a medical exemption, but her list of odd symptoms likely wouldn't make your list. Even if they did, I'm concerned that you couldn't think of every odd symptom that another child that has something that looks autoimmune in nature would not be cared for in this situation. I agree that these diseases we're talking about are serious, but I believe that the symptoms and possible chronic conditions from vaccines are far more likely to occur and could be much more devastating. Like any parent, it's my job to make sure Marin is kept as safe as possible, and I feel like it would be very unsafe to vaccinate her. Because of this, if we're faced with being required to do that, it feels like we would have no choice but to leave. We would have to choose our child's health over our life here. My husband's had his job for 18 years. The two of us own 4 successful businesses in this state, and we have a lot of family and friends here, but it would not be enough to hold us here. I can't make a choice that I feel like would truly compromise her lifelong comfort. So one last thing I wanted to add, that I have heard a lot of things stated today that were talking about the safety of vaccines, and I think the jury is still out on that, honestly. Two things that haven't been mentioned is that Congress, the U.S. Congress, heard testimony from medical students that they were taught to lie about vaccine injury in medical school. And the other one, that in the 90s, it was published that Japan, which used to be the 17th safest place for a baby to be living in the world, became the 2nd safest place the next time they did a study, and it was, they believed, based on the fact that they changed their vaccination age from 2 months to 2 years. So vaccinating our babies has very serious concerns, I think, and we have plenty of evidence to that end.
Thank you so much. Is Sonia Grable here? Okay. And Maggie Sokol and Corinna Killian. Please start.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Sonia Grable. I'm from Hillsboro. I also have the desire to protect children. There's nothing more important to me than that. But this is the wrong way to do that. Parents are opting out of vaccines because they have concerns about the safety of the vaccine program. You don't solve that with forced vaccination. It's just going to push parents further away. You solve it by listening to the concerns and addressing them. We have the power to make changes to the vaccine schedule. Instead of repeating over and over again that vaccines are safe and reactions are extremely rare, which is a disservice to the many, disservice to the many families living with vaccine damage, and ignores the lack of studies using true placebos, and the problem with underreporting. Instead, push for change. Take vaccines reactions seriously. Disallow those with a conflict of interest to serve on the ACIP committee. Make the VAERS reporting mandatory in the cozy relationship between the FDA, the CDC, and the pharmaceutical companies. Eliminate vaccine monopolies and legal protection so there is a true incentive to improve vaccine safety. Fix these problems and the vaccines will sell themselves. There's been a lot of talk about the immunocompromised, and I am very concerned about them as well. But I don't think that mandatory vaccination is going to magically make the world safer for them. There are still countless other illnesses that they could catch, like C. diff, MRSA, colds, stomach viruses, pneumonia, etc. The immunocompromised still need to be very careful in public places, stay away from crowded places, wear masks, etc. It's unethical to ask a healthy child to take a risk to protect another child. If we really want to help the immunocompromised, we'd improve the laws around sick leave so that parents can stay home when their child is sick rather than send them to school, and make it so that workers can stay home when they are sick rather than expose the public. That would be far more useful in helping the immunocompromised. It's already been said that some vaccines shed. So, I mean, to say that everybody needs to be vaccinated and send them out into the world, the measles vaccine, the chicken vaccine, some flu vaccines shed, which does put the immunocompromised at risk, so that it's not even a clear statement. We keep being told about outbreaks. The mumps and the whooping cough outbreaks are mostly in the vaccinated populations. And we keep being told that 95% need to be vaccinated to achieve herd immunity. But scientists have been changing this bar repeatedly. Before you know it, they're going to be saying it's 100%. In closing, I think the decision should remain with those who have to live with the consequences. We know that there are reactions. You've heard testimony today from parents who are living it. Are you going to be there to take care of the children who are damaged that we know some will be? Are you going to be legally responsible for those children? Leave the choice with the parents who are going to live with that consequence. Please oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Maggie Sokol, and I have a master's degree in counseling psychology. I work in community mental health. So I'll be brief, and a lot of the things I was going to say, you know, have sort of been covered. But I'm here today to oppose legislation which would further limit citizens' rights regarding the vaccinations they receive. I oppose any amendment to legislation which would remove personal and philosophical belief exemptions to vaccinations. Vaccines are pharmaceutical products that cause injury and death for some. The federal government has paid out more than $3 billion to vaccine victims. Many more people have adverse reactions. A family member said to me in the kitchen, isn't it kind of funny that I have to go and sort of almost, I feel like, beg, you know, these people I don't know, as opposed to having this conversation with my doctor about my daughter's, you know, allergic reactions to things and which vaccines I feel would be safe or wouldn't be safe. She has eczema and, as it turns out, quite a lot of different, you know, allergies. And my partner has had allergic reactions to MSG, and you know, I feel certain if she would have had any vaccines at a very young age, that could have had dire consequences for her and for her immune system. I don't think anybody's talked very much about just some information about the measles. This is from the CDC. In the past 10 years, there have been approximately 4 deaths from measles, but over 100 deaths of children from the MMR vaccine. I feel like it's fatalities and severe injuries that we should be looking at, not necessarily people that are getting sick. There are ways of dealing with the illness, especially now with what we know about nutrition and aids like vitamin A and cod liver oil. I think the real issue here is both safety and efficacy. I think that the jury is out on both of those things. And, you know, the list of ingredients, which others have mentioned, you know, thimerosal, which is still in some of the vaccines, aluminum, which I could go into that as well, MSG, formaldehyde, aborted human fetus cells, on and on. The safety of each and every one of these ingredients could easily be debated and is a neurotoxin. You know, in 1983, the recommended vaccination schedule was 10 vaccines for children under 5. Children today receive 69 doses of vaccines for 16 different viral and bacterial illnesses. This more than doubles the schedule of 34 doses of 11 different vaccines in the year 2000. We have some of the sickest children in the world, and actually courts in Italy and France are both have ruled on cases where, you know, vaccines are causing autism. There are great studies from many places, you know, that are there where they're looking at this. I just want to say finally, there are hundreds of new vaccines in developments, and if you mandate this and take away our rights to choose what we put into our body, I will also have to be one of those families that will think about where it is that I'll need to where I'll need to go, where I can choose how I want to deal with my health care and my child's. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Karina Killian. I want to thank you for staying late to hear all of this testimony. I didn't find out about this until yesterday. I'm a vaccinating mom. I'm offering you a position here today that is completely different than what anybody else has talked about. I haven't done any research on vaccinations. My concern is, as a parent, making decisions for my 3.5-year-old daughter. And not having done the research, frankly, after today, I'm not sure I want to vaccinate. After the testimony that I've heard, I didn't know there were fetal cells in vaccinations that my daughter is getting. Is that going to change my decision? I don't know. But as a parent, I bristle at the idea that somebody else could tell me how to treat my daughter. She's my only daughter, and we had trouble getting to the point where we could actually have a daughter. I would be beyond upset if I were being forced to take medical treatment that I didn't choose for my own daughter. I oppose Bill 442 and the Amendment 3. And frankly, it offends my sensibilities as a taxpayer and an Oregon constituent that we're here today because one person in the state has been affected by an outbreak. And I have yet to hear any statistics about how many of the Oregon public have been affected by obesity and lifelong chronic disease beginning in childhood as a result of lack of education around highly processed and addictive fast food and GMOs. I know that's a whole different issue, but there are a whole lot more people in the public that are being affected by that than are being affected by an outbreak of measles. And that offends my sensibilities as a taxpayer. I think our tax dollars could be better spent in areas where actual lives are being currently affected every day. And it sounds to me from the testimony that I've heard today that more lives are going to be affected in a negative way by implementing this type of bill than are currently being affected by not having it in place. You cannot legislate informed, responsible parenting. It isn't going to happen. There is no way that you can make parents smarter. Parents who want to do the research will do the research and make their decisions. And making those people receive medical treatment for their children that they would not choose is, it's not okay with me. Unlike a lot of the other testimony I've heard, I would probably have to make a choice to leave the state. My last sentence, if you're interested in protecting the public, you're looking in the wrong place.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, can I just say something really quickly? I've been listening very carefully. Everything that everybody said today, some of you aren't here anymore. Maybe you'll go back and look. And I take your concerns extraordinarily seriously. I became a physician because I believe deeply in helping people stay healthy. That's why I chose family medicine, right? It's the front line, let's keep people healthy. And I have nothing but heartbreak for people whose kids may have been injured by vaccines, have been injured by vaccines. I have nothing but heartbreak for any parent whose child has been injured for anything, any reason whatsoever. I think it's really important to clear up a couple of things really quickly. And I'm particularly concerned about this issue that keeps getting brought up about a tissue from aborted fetuses being in vaccines. I have a longtime colleague, Dr. Walt Larimore, who's been part of Focus on the Family, been part of their medical staff, which, as most of you know, is a pretty conservative Christian organization. He and I have been very, very good friends and close colleagues, despite differences in political perspectives and approaches to the world for a long time. And I'm trying to get this cleared up, but the long story short, he ran a series within the past year or so about vaccine myths. And the one that he made a point of including was the myth that vaccines include cells from aborted fetuses. They don't. And they were, let me be clear, please allow me to finish. Please allow me to finish. One set of things, as one of the people referenced, is grown from cells that were derived from two fetuses in the 1960s. Those cells are still used, those cells have been perpetuated in culture, and they are still used to grow the viruses, but they are not included in there. So if you have an objection based on the fact that these two cell lines have been perpetuated since that time, I get that, and I respect that. But I want to be crystal clear, there are no human cells in these vaccines. There are viruses that have been grown from them, grown in human cells. But that's all. And I just think it's really important to clarify that. And we have to decide about a bunch of things, but I want to make sure that we get the facts straight. And I have to tell you that Walt Larimore is one of the strongest pro-life people I've ever met in my life. And I have enormous respect for him, even though he and I have a different perspective on that issue. And if he's saying that, I'm going to trust him. So I just want to get that clear. But I do have huge respect for everybody who's come and testified, and I thank you all very much for the time that you've taken to come and talk with us, as Senator Mona Sanderson has. I'll happily continue to stay here.
Okay. I have three more here. Carrie Singh, Jessica Adamson, and Caleb Hayes. Are they here? And is there anyone else that has not testified?
Can I ask a quick clarification?
No. Please, you can put it in writing and submit it to the committee assistant. Was it Josh? Yeah. Please submit it in writing. Okay. Is Josh Balick? No, I think he's left.
I'll text him.
And Debbie Farr? Okay. Corey, is it Corey? Okay. So why don't we let the one with the baby speak first, because I'm a grandma, and I know what it's like to have a little one.
My apologies if I have to stand. She has not had a nap. We've been here for a while.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much. I'll get my notes out here. I'm Corey Singh. I live in Staten. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for allowing me to speak. I think, like most of us have said in the last several rounds here, that a lot of things have been said that I'd wanted to say already, so I will keep this short and sweet. I guess for me, what I really want to say today is I don't think this is a vaccine issue. I have my opinions on vaccines. I respect other people's opinions on vaccines. I think this is a human rights issue. I think in the United States of America that it is just appalling to me that we're even having this conversation, because our country was founded on the tenets of religious and personal freedoms, and this is both of those things to me. She agrees.
Good advocate.
I have friends that vaccinate. I have friends that don't. I respect all of their choices for their children. And I'm just asking that my choices for my children be respected, and that means that they're able to get adequate schooling that my tax dollars pay for, regardless of whether I feel comfortable vaccinating them or not. One more thing here. And like I said, for religious reasons, for personal reasons, I believe as a parent, as an American, that it is my right and my responsibility to make those choices for my own children, but it's not the job of the state, it's not the job of the government to tell me how to best care for them. You said you have a grandchild. I think, you know, many of us are mothers, fathers, grandparents, and I think all of us can agree, no matter which side of this issue that we're on, that parents know best. Know what's best for their children. Good parents know what's best for their children. And I'm asking that this amendment not be passed, because it takes away my right to do what I know is best for my children. So thank you again. I'll step away.
Thank you very much.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Caleb Hayes.
Josh.
I'm here on behalf of the College of Osteopathic Medicine of the Pacific Northwest, also known as COMP Northwest, the DO school in Lebanon, and I'm here in support of Senate Bill 442. I'll keep my comments brief, as we have already heard from a great doctor of osteopathy, Senator Alan Bates, in support of this important piece of legislation. At COMP Northwest, we believe leadership is the responsibility of every physician. And considering the public health risks that come with our state's low immunization rates, we have seen critically needed leadership from this bipartisan group of legislators who sponsored and spoke in favor of this bill, including Senator Steiner Hayward, Bates, Mona Sanderson, Thompson, and Rosenbaum, as well as Representative Newt Bueller. COMP Northwest thanks each and every one of you for taking leadership to keep our communities healthy, and we urge the committee to join these leaders in supporting Senate Bill 442. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of Providence Health and Services. Providence is Oregon's largest hospital and health system, and as many of you know, we are a Catholic healthcare institution. We believe Senate Bill 442 and the Dash 3 Amendment are not only good medicine, but they are important to the overall population health of Oregon and to our children. We are strongly supportive of the amendment. In particular, we want to thank the chief sponsor, Senator Steiner Hayward, for including language that will set a statewide standard for what is and what is not a medical exclusion as determined by public health officials in the Oregon Health Authority. We think that's very helpful that be interpreted the same way statewide. In addition to everything else that makes sense about this bill, I want to share with you some words from Dr. Doug Kukuk, who is our chief executive of clinical operations, about how this isn't just good medicine, but this is central to our mission as a Catholic healthcare organization. Providence believes that vaccines are also part of our mutual responsibility to care for one another. This tradition is fundamental to religious and spiritual teaching and the cornerstone of our mission to care for the poor and vulnerable. In this circumstance, those would include young infants and individuals with rare medical conditions who cannot receive vaccinations. At Providence, we take our mission very seriously, and we believe that this legislation helps to move forward public policy that really will protect those that are unable to be vaccinated against really serious illnesses. So we thank you for your leadership and encourage support for this bill.
Thank you. Josh?
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Josh Ballack, representing the Coalition for Healthy Oregon, or COHO, which is organizations that work with 8 of the 16 CCOs in the state of Oregon. We are very much in support of this bill and the Dash 3 amendments. Immunizations are a major part of public health, and that is one of the major charges of the CCOs, is to make sure there is public health. On a little bit of a more personal story, my father actually had polio and was actually telling a tale around the table, and my then 5-year-old daughter looked at me and said, "What is polio?" And I got to look her right in the eye and say, "Something you don't have to worry about." And it's measures like this that actually will make it so that I can tell that to my 2-year-old little girl here in a little bit. So thank you for your leadership. Thank you for hearing this measure, and hopefully we can pass it together.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone. I think I'd like to tell the committee and publicly why I signed on the bill. My sister's deaf, and she was deaf because my mother had the measles when she was pregnant with my sister Janet. And there were 2 other mothers that also their children were born deaf, and one of them had a lot of other disabilities. Her husband, she's 70 years old now, and her husband had pertussis when he was 2 years old and became profoundly deaf. When I was in first grade, one of my good friends had polio, and she was in the braces. And so in second grade is when we were polio pioneers, and that's when they started giving polio vaccine to all of us. And I was one of those that fainted. But that is why, from my perspective, I see what the diseases actually have done without vaccination. And I hear what you're saying. You have this fear of what the side effects of vaccinations, but I needed to put that on record. And thank you. With that, are any other comments? We will be having an informational hearing only. That means it's not public testimony on March 11th. And we're not exactly sure exactly who the speakers will be, but there will be opponents invited as well as opponents. Proponents.
March 9th.
With that, we're adjourned. Oh, before we adjourn, I want to make sure everyone has to clear out. The state police need to clear the rooms. You can't come up here. You just need to leave because we are way over when we should be locking the doors. We're adjourned.
I'm delighted to talk to you after.